Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. I'm going to take a look back at last Friday. Not a good day for the governor, not a good day at all. But we're going to look back to the day that was, you know, the voter ID that got turned down, unconstitutional, and also his bailing on the children in Philadelphia. Also going to take a look ahead at the budget that the governor is going to throw out, especially the education portion of it. Now, I understood that Friday he was supposed to stand in front of those kids and say, no, you know, I know I've beaten you up the last couple of years. I know I've stolen a bunch of money from you to give away, but I'm going to give you a little bit of it back. And that was my understanding. That's what that was all about. But then at the last minute, maybe change of mind, change of heart, maybe someone else wanted a handout. So he bailed. I'll talk about that. Also, the voter ID thing. Not so much done, is it, Mike Terzai? The reality is, the court said, unconstitutional. The right wing in the state going nuts. Absolutely ballistic that Corbett hasn't come out and said, we're going to appeal it. Now, I would have to think, I've got to give Corbett credit for something. I would think being a former attorney general, having half a legal mind, that you would go, yeah, there's really not much to stand on. Now, in our conversations last week with one of the lead attorneys, she didn't give me much hope that Corbett would. I thought, as a matter of course, Corbett, it's not his money, it's ours, right? Just throw it out there. But it looks like we'll see. So I'm still waiting for a response. We'll find out. Also, the attack on workers continues. We'll talk a little bit more about House Bill 1507 and Senate Bill 1034. And I hope you're calling your senators. I hope you're calling your representatives saying, hey, not doing it. In fact, I hope a bunch of people will come and join me tomorrow at 10 o'clock as we head over to Representative Stephen Bloom's office to say, hey, I don't think this is a good idea. And now, look, I understand. Bloom is full bore on board with this. But he's got to know that there are people out there who disagree. And I got to be honest, I want to hear him throw out those talking points. I got to hear it. Even though he knows that they're fallacious at best. So that'll be interesting. Again, I hope that people will come out and join us 10 o'clock tomorrow morning out on Rittner Highway. As we go and say hello to the representative. In fact, his address is 1227 Rittner Highway there in Carlisle. So hopefully people will come out and join me and say hello. Also, in the third hour of the program, I'm going to take a look back to the People's Tour for America when we visited Memphis, the place where Dr. King was murdered. That'll be interesting as well. I'd like your thoughts, your questions, comments. You know, what does Martin Luther King Day mean to you? Does it mean anything? I've met a couple people who say, you know, it's a moment of taking a look back and examining the dream, whatever that was, and how do we make ourselves a better society, a better country? And then some who say, well, I don't care. Personally, I do care. And I think if we took that kind of an attitude that we can take a moment and think about how we make tomorrow better, I think we'd be a much better society. Much better society. Now, this afternoon, I went and I picked up. You can give us a call here, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. I'd love your thoughts, comments, questions, whatever's on your mind on that. Also, email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. So I went and I picked up my daughter, my five-year-old, who's doing the preschool thing. And, you know, I is the ritual. I pick her up, and she comes running out, Daddy, Daddy, Daddy. And I go, what'd you learn today? What'd you do today? Tell me about, you know, the hours you spent. And it's usually filled with, here's what we did in our craft class, and here's what, here's the multiplication problem I learned, and look at the book I'm reading. But today was interesting. I said, so what'd you learn? She goes, I learned about Dr. Martin Luther King. I go, no kidding, what'd you learn? She goes, I didn't learn anything. In fact, I taught. I said, really? She goes, yeah. I said, look, I was at the place. I was there. I went to see his statue, and I went to see where he got shot. And I'm going, wow. And she's just rattling on. And, you know, when we were on the tour, when we were going across country, I didn't know how much the kids would absorb, especially going into Memphis, because it was such a huge, in Memphis and Little Rock and some of the other places, it was such a lot of history, and it was really densely compacted. And, you know, she just started rattling off things that she remembered, you know, looking up at the balcony where King was shot at, and explaining this stuff in such vivid detail. I got great hope. I got great hope for the future. I'm hoping all kids are like her. That her mind is just a sponge, which is why I go back again. I am all in favor of universal pre-K. I am all in favor of, as soon as you can get kids learning, the better it is, because her mind is just a sponge. She soaks up everything. But you know, it got me to thinking, because she threw it out. She goes, well, he gave a nice speech. He gave a really great speech, I'm told. The I Have a Dream speech, and she knew that. And as I sat there and I thought about it, that's really, I think, what most of my friends know. Most of the people who I talked to today, well, he gave the I Gave a Dream speech. He fought for civil rights. And while that's true, it's only partly true. And, you know, I got to be honest, growing up as a kid, that's what I learned. Great speech. In fact, I didn't even learn that he was in Memphis standing with the sanitation workers. I don't ever remember a reason being given why he was in Memphis. And in fact, I've asked a number of people over the last several years if they know why. And most people don't. A handful, yeah. He was there for the sanitation workers. But the majority of people didn't know. And to this day, I still think don't know. And why that's important is it's not just about black-white relations. It's just not about integration. It's not just about desegregation. It was about much more than that. And someone sent me the last speech that King gave at the Southern Christian Leadership Council back in 1967. Now, there are people on the right. And as one person told me, my representative, Stephen Bloom, was one of them, who is trying to turn King into a right-winger, trying to turn him into a conservative, if you will. I look at this, and I look at this speech that he gave at the Southern Christian Leadership Council, where he's talking about, where do you go? Where do you go from here? He said, you know, one day we must ask the question, why are there 40 million people in America who are poor? And when you begin to ask that question, you're raising questions about the economic system, about a broader distribution of wealth, he said. When you ask that question, you begin to question the capitalistic economy. And I'm simply saying that more and more, we've got to begin asking questions about the whole society. When we're called upon to help the discouraged beggars in life's marketplace. But one day we must come to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. He says it means that questions must be raised. He says, you see, my friends, when you deal with this, you begin to ask the question of who owns the oil? You begin to ask the question, who owns the iron ore? You begin to ask the question, why is it that people have to pay water bills in a world that's two-thirds water? There are questions that must be asked. And again, he's not talking about black and white here. He's talking about green, which has always been my thought on this. I see things not in black and white. I see things in where's the money? And I've been saying about Pope Francis, he better get the Pope Mobile out, because it's okay to talk about injustice. It's okay to talk about, you know, feeding the poor and all that stuff. It's a whole nother thing to start talking about the greedy. It's a whole nother thing to talk about the hoarding at the very top. The idolatry of money, the idolatry of greed, just saying. But in that speech, you know, he goes on to say that, you know, he's not talking about communism. He said that communism forgets life is individual, but he also says capitalism forgets that life is social. He says, and the kingdom of brotherhood is found neither on these theses of communism or the antithesis of capitalism, but on a higher synthesis. It is found in a higher synthesis that combines the truths of both. He says, now when I say questioning of the whole society, It means ultimately coming to see the problems of racism, the problem of economic exploitation, and the problem of war, all tied together. These, he said, are the triple evils that are interrelated. That's what scares moneyed interest. When they can no longer pit us. And, you know, this is the much bigger picture. When they can no longer pit us black against white, black against Hispanic, white against Hispanic. When they can no longer pit us against each other, blue collar and white collar. When they can no longer pit us against each other, male and female. When they can no longer subdivide us and slice us and dice us and keep us separated. When they can no longer do that, they lose. And they understand that, which is why you're seeing all of this money being poured into these anti-worker campaigns. Because you know what? There's a groundswell of people who have been screwed the last 5 years trying to get some handle on where they go from here. And the wealth class knows. We better crush those unions before those people who we've been screwing for the last 5 years, well, for the last couple of generations, wake up to the reality that they can be empowered. That they have the ability to take what we give them and stand up. And as one of my old black friends told me years ago, he said, what King taught us is that we could take whatever the white man gave us. We could take the beatings, we could take the abuse, and we could still hold on to our dignity and move forward. And that scared the hell out of them. He said, you know, King's dream was fully realized that as a black man in the South, he never felt, again, like he was afraid. Which, you know, I go back and I think about him often. Because I think that's really powerful. Now, there are those who are saying, well, the dream's not fulfilled. And maybe not. Maybe not entirely. We have massive inequality. In fact, I think things have gotten much worse on the inequality front than it was even during King's time. I think we're heading in the back to a segregated society. Both on race issues, but more on economic issues. And you look at the education system. We're dividing along who can afford to send their kids to decent schools. We're dividing on who can get the ID card to go vote. You know, I look at our school system. Look how they've destroyed education in the inner cities. And they've used it as a divisive tool. Because lily white suburban America thought, hey, it's not us he's talking about. That's not us the profiteers are talking about. That's not us who's being harmed by these horrible budgets. Until one way, a day you wake up and realize it was us. It was all of us. And that's the part here. And we better figure it out, and we better figure it out quick. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, I'll talk a little bit about Corbett's visit to Philadelphia on Friday and where we go from here. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
You are demanding that this city will respect the dignity of labor, not only Memphis, but you are reminding the nation that it is a crime for people to live in this rich nation and receive starvation wages.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. speaking in Memphis, Tennessee. As the nation commemorates a civil rights icon today, his words resonate far beyond the scope of civil rights. Dr. King was killed supporting the rights of striking sanitation workers in Memphis, Tennessee. He said in his writings that he leaned more towards socialist than capitalist economic beliefs, and he was anti-war. After civil rights victories, he said he wanted to march on poverty. Labor unions marched with Dr. King and came to his aid when he needed it. Dr. King said the civil rights movement and labor has identical needs. Decent wages, fair working conditions, livable housing, and old age security. And he warned even then against the so-called right-to-work laws being pushed by anti-union, anti-worker politicians today. He said we must guard against being fooled by false slogans like right-to-work. He called it a law to rob us of our civil rights and job rights. Its purpose, he said, is to destroy labor unions and the freedom of collective bargaining by which unions have improved the wages and working conditions of everyone. In Memphis today, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference is supporting locked-out Kellogg's workers with a march as part of the King Day actions. David Durkee, president of the Bakers Union, BCTGM, will lead the march and speak. 220 workers have been locked out by Kellogg's since October. The multi-billion-dollar profitable company locked out the workers after demanding that they agree to concessions that would create a casual part-time workforce. The union says the company wants to replace steady middle-class full-time jobs with casual part-time employees who would make significantly lower wages and substandard benefits. Barely 2 weeks into his first term, and New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio is moving on a paid sick leave ordinance for city workers. It would extend paid sick days to 360,000 New York workers who don't have them now. He announced the move, saying that City Hall is going to be on the side of working families all over the city. The new law would require that businesses with more than five employees provide five paid sick days each year. This proposal would never have made it past former Mayor Mike Bloomberg, but the new mayor and a more progressive city council makes this and other pro-worker actions possible now in New York City. To support Workers Independent News, you can donate now at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Every now and then I visit an elementary school. Talking with children is a pretty good idea, I think. They ask questions we don't think about, and they ask them very directly. Recently, a little girl wanted to know, what's the hardest part of your job? That got me thinking. I looked down and I told her, the hardest part is telling people no.
Well, you know, he didn't seem to have a problem telling the kids at Central High School there in Philadelphia, no, I'm not coming, even though I said I was. And the reports that I kept getting is that's where he said, hey, he was going to say, hey, I'm going to give some of the money I've taken back. I'm going to give you a little bit back, just a little taste, not a lot, don't get carried away, but a little bit, not enough to replace all of the teachers you lost. Because if you look at the numbers, look at pre-corporate, the Central High School had 145 full-time staff. Now, thanks to Corbett, down to 111 full-time staff. They had eight counselors before Corbett, down to two. They had six secretaries, down to two. They had four non-teaching assistants, people who, you know, did hall duty and did all kinds of other things. Now there are none. School had a librarian. And, you know, it's a luxury to have a librarian. Understand that. Now none. And you go down the list of all the things that this school once had. Now none, thanks to Corbett. And I found it to be kind of a disgrace that he had chosen this school to go and give the governor's academic achievement award to when it's him who seems to be wanting things to be much worse. But I was glad he canceled. I got to be honest, I was glad he canceled. It shows his commitment to education. But I do want to talk to somebody who did show up to Central High School and you know, was there to make sure that people were honest and decent, which is why we've asked Susan Gobreski. She's an executive director of the Education Voters PA, educationvoterpa.org is the website. Susan, thanks for taking time for us.
Hi, Rick. Thanks for having me on.
So were you surprised that the governor bailed on Friday?
Actually, I was. I was surprised when he scheduled in the first place. But, you know, governors have to do things that are hard, and they have to go to places where their ideas may not be popular. So I was surprised that he scheduled it, but I have to say after he scheduled it, I was really surprised that he ran away and didn't walk in the door of a school to give an award. I mean, who turns their back on kids?
Now, you know, I look at this, and I had a couple of people tell me that this would have been the first visit to a district public school since he's been governor. Is that true?
That's my understanding.
And you look at this and you go, I understand he doesn't believe in public education, because you can only look at his budgets and the policies that he pushed to come to that conclusion, this promoting charter schools over public schools. To me, that's all I have to look at.
Well, right. I mean, I think that's right. He, you know, I think that his, you know, your priorities are what you spend time on and what you devote resources to, and he has done neither of those things on public education. And, you know, I think that he's an ideologue, right? He, you know, there are people in this country who believe that everyone should fend for themselves and that there's not a greater good to be served. And, you know, they forget about things like roads and bridges and that public education actually creates a rising tide, right? It creates people who can fend for themselves and who can help create jobs and who can help coach soccer and who start small businesses. But he does not seem all that terribly interested in supporting and strengthening that.
So now, what was the award for that he was? Why was he there? Why was he going to be there? Why did he originally say, "I'm going to come to this school"?
The award was for the school's achievement. The school has done very well in terms of outputs and results. You know, both in typical measures like test scores or you know, things that some people think are important. And then, you know, it's a well-known school for great programs, great community, great resources for a city school that brings people together. So the award was for the achievement and test scores, and the people there work really hard, and the kids are very accomplished, and the faculty work really hard, and it was a really well-deserved award.
So
he didn't do it.
But, you know, here's the thing. If I'm the principal of the school, I don't know that I want him there. Because, you know, if I look at my budgets over the last couple of years, you look at the, you know, the numbers I threw out there, they cut, what was it, 33 faculty positions, no librarian, you gotta start looking at, and then the money for books and the money for other things, all cut. The school achieved at a high rate. No thanks to him.
Well, that's certainly true. But he scheduled the visit, and, you know, and it's my understanding that, Principal McKenna was going to handle it gracefully and graciously. And, you know, when the governor wants to come to your school, that's what you're supposed to do.
Yeah.
People are supposed to behave like grown-ups. And, you know, there are civilities that we all go through together and decency, you know, decent acts. And one of the decent acts of a governor is to walk into a school in a place that didn't vote for him and give a deserved award.
Right.
And the governor chose to leave and not show up. I, like I said, people are like, "Oh, you were really surprised?" And I was like, I really was.
No, I was surprised that he bailed.
Yeah.
I'm like you, on both ends. I was surprised that he scheduled it, that it wasn't at a charter school, and then I was surprised that you would bail last minute. I don't care who's standing out front screaming or carrying on or holding a sign. Now, heaven forbid, a sign might end things.
Well, you know, I mean, that's right. I mean, you know, and people of character face people who disagree with them and, you know, talk it out or agree to disagree in the, you know, again, he walked away. What I thought was really, sad was that he said he didn't run from anything. And, you know, on that very day, he had done that. You know, the other thing is that when the governor comes to your school, it sends the school, right? People stop what they were doing and start preparing for a visit. They want to make sure that they change schedules and then they make staffing adjustments and that they, you know, figure out what the plan for the day is and they prepare. And, you know, it's very disruptive and in a positive way. Even the governor, you know, any governor walking in the door of your building is a positive thing for your school. And so people spent a whole lot of time that week doing something that was focused on Corbett's visit to have him abandon it. I was kind of shocked.
Yeah, but looking at it from the frame that, in retrospect, the shock was, while it was, probably not surprising. And I look at his budgets. His budgets have been atrocious. They've been destructive to public education. And, you know, the words that I had heard was, this is where he was going to add some money back. So as we look forward, Susan, and we look forward to the budget coming up, his address is coming up here, I guess, the first week of February sometime?
February 4th.
So, you know, what are we expecting budget-wise? I gotta assume, you know, I've seen rumors, but you gotta assume it's election time. He's gotta put some money back that he's taken from education.
Well, right. So I think here's where I think the lay of the land is. I think that the governor's numbers are poor. Education is constantly mentioned as one of the reasons that his policies are unpopular. He needs to look good on education, and or to try to look good and do some damage control. So he's been beat up, rightfully, on the budget cuts. So he's going to want to try and put money in the budget, and he's, I think my expectation, he's going to want to put as little as he can to look like he did something significant. But more importantly, I think the other thing that we're going to watch is, does he try and condition it on anything, right? Does he play politics and say, well, I put money in the budget as long as I can get, you know, pension changes, or something like that, where he really tries to exploit what people, you know, what our kids really need, right? They need librarians. They need guidance counselors. And I just have to disagree. I don't disagree with you often, Rick, but you said a librarian is a luxury. It is a luxury in Philadelphia these days, but it really shouldn't be. A librarian is really a right. Schools that have librarians do better. The kids do better. They grow up they're more self-sufficient when it comes to their own learning when they have a librarian. So,
I'm sure you sensed my sarcasm.
Yeah, I did. So he's going to propose something in the budget. I think what we're concerned about is whether or not it's going to meet any sort of reasonable metric, whether or not it's going to be focused on going into the classroom. The money that has been put back in, and it was minuscule over the past couple of years, has gone to pay for things other than classroom programs. Now, those things are obligations as well.
Right.
There's responsibilities. We make a commitment to teachers. We make a commitment to communities about how we're going to support the budgets of our schools. So they're all still obligations. But the reality is that money has not, we're losing ground in our classrooms. Class sizes are getting bigger. We're cutting programs. We're cutting school nurses in Philadelphia, for example.
Yeah, I had a listener who recently reminded me of one of the, he's one of our podcasters who reminded me of LaPortia Massey, who, over the thing, he took a very hard stance, basically calling Corbett a murderer for his cutting the budgets. I'm not going to go quite that far, but for there not being a nurse at that school, so that sixth grader didn't have an opportunity to be seen by a nurse, and who knows what would have happened had there been a nurse there.
Well, that's right, and we'll never know, and her family will never know, and they'll have to live and wonder all their life, and that's the thing, as a parent, that we wake up sweating, right, is that worrying that something will happen to our kids, and it will be because we didn't do something we could have done, and that's exactly what happens, so it's going to happen and haunt LaPortia's family and many of the rest of us for a long time.
Well, for me, I went to my local school and I asked, do you have a nurse on staff all the time? And I actually went and it's something I never thought of though, Susan. I just thought every school had one. Every school has a nurse. Every school has a librarian. It's part of what a school is.
That's right. And he had a pot of money, $45 million that, we had thought, debt forgiveness. But it was money that Pennsylvania had many, many years ago was supposed to pay the federal government. And the federal government actually approved using that $45 million to provide for Philadelphia because of the cuts. So that $45 million is something that Tom Corbett is perfectly happy to take credit for. Do I get to coin that term, Tom Credit?
Yeah.
and he'll take credit for it, but it was actually, those were actually federal dollars. And he was holding out because he was seeking, trying to use it as leverage in the union negotiations,
yeah,
holding that money hostage as kids didn't have nurses, as kids didn't have guidance counselors. So that was one of the things that happened. And what I'm concerned about is that the numbers that he's going to propose in this year's budget, people are talking about 100 to 2 million, and really it needs to be like 350. If we were to restore the $1 billion in cuts that have been made, then last year should have been 320-ish million. This year should have been 320 million, right? So that's 640. We're at about 120. It really should be in the 400 million range. Now, that's probably, maybe a little bit high given the context of the budget and the other obligations that we have. But we should be looking at something like $300 million this year. And I'm worried that they're not going to meet that.
Yeah, but Susan, we're broke, don't you know? We just don't have any money.
We've not spent broke.
We've spent all of our money going after trying to privatize the wine and spirit shops and the lottery and this idiotic voter ID thing.
We've
got plenty of money for that stuff, but not much for education.
It's a mess. There's money. We have money. And we're choosing not to take advantage of we're choosing not to take advantage of the Marcellus Shale, closing corporate loopholes, tobacco and smokeless tobacco taxes. There are other types of money. These are people who don't want government to succeed, so they're trying to drown it in the bathtub.
Oh, Susan, you must be one of those people who's trying. I've heard this 1,000 times already. You must be one of those people who want to kill the goose that lays the golden egg.
I actually, I like roads. I like bridges. I like knowing my neighbors have good jobs. I like property values. I like being able to earn a decent living and be able to provide for my family. I like hard work. I like knowing my tax dollars go to support and create jobs that allow my neighbors to make our community stronger. Isn't that crazy?
That's
crazy
insane. Talk. See, it's that hippie liberal talk you've got going on there.
I wish.
We just can't have that. If we had a lot of money, that would be a nice hobby. But we've got a billionaire class to build. Don't you know that?
Oh, I know.
The 1% is starving. They need your money.
But listen, the other thing that we need to be doing is making sure that people are mobilizing and voting.
Yes.
We're going to need to make sure that we are asking tougher questions. The other issue is that the governor, one of the things that we've been able to do is to make sure that there are a lot of people in a lot of districts taking a lot of heat for what's happening in Harrisburg. So, the governor is incredibly important, and people are going to need to make sure that they turn out. Some people think that they're going to be able to take this election for granted, and I think it's going to be really important that people get out and do a couple things. They're going to have to make sure they vote. They're going to have to make sure that their neighbors vote. They're going to have to make sure that, another half a dozen people vote. They're going to have to vote like they did when they wanted Obama to be president, because that's the way that we get better public policy when the public is more engaged and watching. And we're going to have to ask a lot of tough questions, like, are you willing to vote for increased sources of revenue of state representatives and state senators? Because if we put that kind of heat on, we're going to get much better action in this year's budget and next year's election.
Yeah, I'm with you. But those are tough questions. It's much easier to have what the Republicans leading our state right now are throwing at us, a tax on workers, telling us that, if we stop collecting dues, we could save money by having that checkoff taken away, even though it saves no money. It would be so much easier. We would have more money if people could save their dues money. I love this argument. It's such a nonsensical, ridiculous argument. If we took the rights of workers away, we would have more money and more jobs.
Well, I think what's really going to be really important is if all of the folks listening to your show make sure that they walk into a town hall in the next 3 months, right, before the primary, and ask legislators some questions at one of their public appearances, Where are you on supporting our public schools? Would you like to see a funding formula? What are you going to do? Not just do you think those things are good ideas and would you support them if, some other magic fairy made it happen, but what are you going to do to move the ball on getting more funding into the classroom, getting class sizes to be smaller, making sure we have strong public schools in every community, not just a few? What are you going to do about making sure Pennsylvania has revenues? What are you going to do about our roads and bridges? And I know they passed the transportation bill, but they need to continue to feel
like
they're on the hook for the infrastructure that we have. And schools are infrastructure, and jobs are infrastructure, and unions are infrastructure.
You're talking about a fair funding formula, and in a second I'll ask you what you would think is a fair funding formula. But I was looking at the numbers at Central High School. And it's all, the figures are from the school district there in Philadelphia. After Corbett, the fiscal year of 2014, it's about $5,100 per kid in funding. I saw something not too long ago that one of the Montgomery County schools spent something like $20,000 per student. There seems to me to be a huge difference based on your zip code, based on your address, on what we're spending on the children's future. And, I was under the impression our Constitution gave equal access, and it was supposed to say, we all have the same kind of shot. I don't know that funding at $20,000 and funding at $5,000 is equal.
It's really funny. We have legislators who go to hearings, and when they think the newspapers are watching, they say, we want to have the best schools. We want to be like Finland. That's the mantra of people who want to look like they're committed to education. We should be doing what they're doing in Finland, except for they don't want to do anything that they're doing in Finland. We do it just fast backwards you know, where we spend the most money on the kids who actually are the most well-prepared and have the most resources already and have the least amount of diverse educational needs and the least amount of money on the kids with the greatest needs. Poverty is a huge factor.
Yes.
Early learning is a huge factor. It's a huge way to close. And we, you know, those of us who do this all the time, believe that people should not call it an achievement gap. It's an opportunity gap, right? That that what we're providing for kids is an opportunity gap. And so early education closes the opportunity gap. Reading support, tutoring closes the opportunity gap. Small class size. And we really need to focus on those things. And the spending disparities are huge. And, you know, people say that money doesn't matter. Well, money sort of in general, just thrown at a budget without purpose and direction, doesn't matter. But just in the same way in your house, if you start investing in things and, you know, doing the right maintenance and deriving your money at the specific things that that the programs that kids need, it actually matters tremendously.
Yeah.
And money is program. Money is teachers. Money is science, money is technology, money is recess time, money is tutoring, money is books.
And the other part of that is money really matters when you don't have it.
Yeah.
And you can't hire a librarian or a nurse or, heaven forbid, a math or a science teacher.
That's right.
It just is what it is. Susan, so we're to get out, go to the town halls, contact our legislators, scream, holler, carry on, all that, right?
Make sure that they know and make sure that, you know, talk about a funding formula left and right. I don't know. Do you want me to talk about a funding formula for a minute?
No, we can save that for another time. I'm running out of time here. I just wanted to make sure we're all heading out to our legislators' offices and making phone calls.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you for always doing everything you do to keep this stuff front and center.
I appreciate your time, Susan. Thanks so much. Susan Gobrusky, Executive Director of Education Voters PA, the website educationvoterspa.org. We've got a link at therickSmithShow.com. Just click on Susan's name. Quick break, back with your thoughts, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show.
10% of the people own 90% of the world. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
The rich truly are different from you and me. They tend to become Congress critters. You don't find many plumbers, mine workers, dirt farmers, Walmart associates, beauty parlor operators, taxi drivers, or other get-the-job-done Americans among the 535 members of the U.S. House and Senate. What you do find is an oversupply of lawmakers drawn from a very thin strata of America's population, millionaires. The Center for Responsive Politics reports that last year, for the first time in history, more than half of our senators and House members are in the Millionaires Club. Indeed, the average net worth, the value of what they own minus what they owe, for all lawmakers now totals more than $7 million each. The world in which our representatives live is light years from where the majority of people live, and the divide between the governors and the governees is especially stark for the 40% of people whose net worth is zero. Or technically less than zero, since their income and other assets are far exceeded by their debts. This widening chasm is not just a matter of wealth, but most significantly, a literal separation of the privileged few from the experiences, needs, and aspirations of the many who are struggling to make ends meet and worried that opportunities for their children to get ahead are no longer available to them. This is Jim Hightower saying, the harsh reality is that most Americans are no longer represented in Washington. Chances are that their own members of Congress don't know any struggling and worried people, share nothing in common with them, and can't relate to their real-life needs. Thus, Congress is content to play ideological games with such basics as health care, minimum wage, joblessness, food stamps, and Social Security. America's wealth divide has become a chasm, creating a looming social and political crisis for America that undermines any pretense that ours is a democratic society.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Oh, one life leads to another two lives, covers the other three lives. Now you're in an awful fix. Four lives, you're getting in deeper. Five lives, piling up steeper. Get wise, or you're going to be telling six.
1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. You can also email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Our quote of the day comes from the Reverend William Barber. He's the leader of the Moral Mondays movement in North Carolina. He said, "The greatest myth of our time is the notion that extreme policies harm a small subset of people, such as people of color." He said, "These policies harm us all." What we've seen in North Carolina and other parts of the country are wealthy extremists playing on the fears of working class and white people. And, you know, I would add to that, much to the detriment of all. And, you know, this isn't new. I mean, this really is not anything that's, he didn't dream this up in the middle of the night. This is basically what King was saying back in 67. This is the same thing. When we start asking the question, why do we have so many people living in poverty? Why do so many kids go to bed hungry at night? Why are the jobs low-paying, no-benefit jobs? Why do we have insecurity in the wealthiest country in the world? Why is it that schools don't have nurses and librarians? Why is it, I got to be honest, it was a given in my thought that every school would have a nurse, at the minimum one. Every school would have a librarian, at least one. And I think for most of us, we think that way. It's a given. We're the richest country in the world. We should be able to have these things. Yet not so much. And you go back to, and you think about, you know, you think about the, you know, King and the dream and this call for economic justice. You know, for me, you know, as I got older, it was much more than just racial justice. You know, growing up in the housing projects like I did, you know, I saw firsthand abject poverty in this country, which should be, you know, in my view, criminal, that we have policymakers who have left so many people behind, and then really to demonize them. These were people that I knew wanted to work. And I find it interesting, you know, I was reading some stuff this afternoon, and I came across Harry Belafonte, a quote that he claims King had said to a group of him and others were at Belafonte's apartment in New York. And he's quoted as saying, "What troubles me now is that for all the steps we've taken towards integration," he says he came to believe that we're integrating into a burning house. And the idea was that, you know, we were going to have to become firemen to put out all of these fires. You know, be it the war movement, be it the push to destroy workers' rights, be it the push to keep people separated. The big money of the time that went after keeping us all divided. And, you know, I think he saw, you know, look, you know, the big money's pushing back, especially, and I've always said, you know, while he was out there, you know, being the radical that he was, stirring up people to say, "Hey, you're a man, you have rights," be the head of that movement. As soon as he started saying, "Hey, we want some of the pie, we want some money, we want to be able to feed our families," that's when he became a real danger, and that's when the moneyed interest really, really went after him. So the question then becomes, where do we go from here? You know, on this day, thinking forward, I'm of the mindset that we have to start thinking in the way of how do we make sure we have not just King's dream, but I think everyone's dream, which is to have a secure life with opportunity, where they can retire with dignity, their children can grow up and have great opportunities in safe neighborhoods with good schools. And you have that Norman Rockwell middle class existence, that ability to put food on the table, a roof over the head, without fear, without intimidation, without persecution. Just my thought. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, talk about a couple of things that I think we can be doing to help make the playing field maybe just a little bit leveler. Just a thought. Right back.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
In 1897, miners at collieries throughout northeastern Pennsylvania's anthracite coal region had enough. Conditions were grueling and life was difficult. Miners were frequently cheated out of pay, overcharged for supplies, some they never wanted or received, forced to live in captive company-owned towns, shop at overpriced company-owned stores, even mandated to use the company doctor since fees were deducted automatically from the miner's pay. This, combined with mine owners forcing longer unpaid hours and the Anti-Immigrant Campbell Act of 1897, taxing mine owners for the use of non-native labor, drove miners to strike. Spontaneously starting in Pennsylvania's Lehigh Valley, workers marched north to get other miners to join in the struggle. Their demands were modest, a 10-cent pay raise and a reduction in the cost of gunpowder. They also wanted the freedom to shop in non-company-owned stores of their choosing and see a doctor not owned by the coal company. As the miners moved northward toward Hazleton, mine owners, determined to crush the workers' protest, sent their company-paid police force and strike breakers. Local law enforcement was also on the side of mine owners. Luzerne County Sheriff James Martin, a former mine foreman, deputized 102 local men, arming them with Winchester rifles and sidearms. The group of some 400 miners marching peacefully and unarmed in rows of fours moved onward toward Latimer. Stephen Urich, joining the group outside of Hazleton, taking with him the American flag, shouted, "We have nothing to worry about because we have the American flag to protect us." Within hours and a hail of Winchester bullets, Stephen Urich was gunned down in cold blood, his beloved American flag drenched in his blood and the blood of those who lay murdered and wounded. Eyewitnesses said the sheriff and his hired killers mowed the men down like grass. More than 20 men were murdered on that September day, and more than 50 were wounded, many shot in the back in Labor's Forgotten Massacre. The sheriff and his murderous band were tried for their part in the Latimer Massacre and found not guilty of murdering 20 unarmed peaceful demonstrators. Lest we never forget, or as the wife of a whose life was stolen from him told her children, "You can forgive, but you can't forget." This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.ricksmithshow.com.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. So on the front of inequality, I mean, you look at this, and to me, one of the things that I take from King and the reading that I've done is, yeah, it was about racial integration. It was about equal opportunities racially. But moreover, it was about economics. It was about how do we make sure that people have the ability to get jobs and the ability to lead a life that, an individual life. I look at the numbers, and I saw this really great mashing together of numbers that really just kind of just grabbed me, and and just made me stop and think a bit. The guy named Paul Buckheit, he wrote a piece over at Alternet that caught my attention. That, you know, just looking at the wealth concentration, because I think most of us have this view, and I'm of the mindset too, that, you know, you work hard. You keep your nose to the grindstone. You make what you can, and if you get rich doing it, great. You know, as long as you didn't harm anybody, as long as you didn't screw anybody over, that's kind of how the system works. Okay, I'm okay with this. But when you start seeing this mass accumulation and this enormous amount of wealth going to just a few, to me, that all breaks down. That compact breaks down. Because then you've got people who are just making money off of making money. And he pointed out just 13 people. 13 people. Enough people you could stick in a van. Made more off their investments last year than the entire SNAP budget that feeds some 50 million people a year. Think about that. The entire SNAP budget you had... 13 people. He points out that the richest 400, our heavy 400, pocketed $300 billion, enough to fund the entire social safety net in the country. That's the SNAP benefit, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Food Program, the WIC program, Women, Infants, and Children, Child Nutrition, Earned Income Tax Credit, Social Security, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, the housing for all of that. Less than $300 billion, which is what the top 400 took in 2013. The richest 12,000 people in this country made $40 million apiece in the last year. As the stock market grew and they're making money off of making money. And you look at the richest 400 people in the country own more of the country than the bottom three-fifths. When you've got 400 people who control 60% of the wealth, there's a serious problem. And when you break it down even further, our heavy 400 made about $750 million each last year. Think about this for a second, because this is really very important. Because we like to believe, oh, well, they're working hard and they, you know, they earned it. Are you going to tell me that the 400 people at the top who pocketed $750 million apiece, really? The top 0.1%, 0.01%, 12,000 people. They made $40 million apiece. The top 1%, to get into that heavy 0.1%, 0.1%, 120,000 of us made about $3.6 million each. And then the heavy 1%. In order for you to get into that 1%, of which there's a little over a million families in this country, you need to take about $830,000 each. That's to get you into the top 1%. And then you break it down even further. Then from 830,000, the drop-off is enormous. So you've got the 1%, and these are the people who are doing, which is why you hear so much about the 1% versus the 99%. To get into the 1%, you've got to make at least 830,000. That fall-off into the 2%, the 5%, is about 300,000. So you've got a massive drop. Then... from 5% to get into the top 10, that's 6 to 10%. There's an even farther drop off from 300,000 down to 95,000, and that's when you start getting into, okay, now you got the top 10%, 95,000 doesn't sound like an awful lot of money, and even in that 10%, there's an awful lot of stratification because you got 6 million families in this country that are in that $95,000 a year range. That's not all that outrageous. I'm not opposed to that. God bless you. You're doing well. But then there's a further drop-off. When you get into that next 11 to 20% range, you're talking about 39 grand a year. Still not a bad living, not a bad income. You've got about 12 million households that are in that range. But then there's the drop-off, where now you're starting to talk about poverty, where you got 21 to 40% of the country in this, about 24 million households, in the $13,000 range. And when you start dropping down even further, where you're talking about, you know, 24 million households make about $4,000 a year, you start going, how's that possible? And you keep going down, you keep going down. And you keep thinking, you know, how's this going to help the future? How are we going to fund education? How are we going to make sure that there's opportunity for our kids? You know, we're told that, you know, they're going to invest all this money and they're going to create jobs. We're told, oh, you give the wealthy, the people who know what to do with it, the money and they'll create jobs. And, you know, maybe on Fantasy Island that happens. But here in the real world, money is about making more money, regardless of how it's done. And I look at the Kellogg situation. We talked to the president of the local out in Memphis last week. Kellogg actually asked their workers and the union to go to their local government, to go to their state, ask for tax breaks, beg for subsidies, under the guise that it was in their best interest to do so. Because if the company does right, well, right, then the workers will do well, right? Isn't that what we're told? If the company does well, then you'll do well and everything will be great. Well, what actually happened was, and this is just not Kellogg, this is a lot of companies. What ends up happening is the company got the money, got the tax breaks, hooray, padded the bottom line. They then automated, laid off the workers, and now that they've done that, they're trying to kick these people to the curb. They locked them out. Is that right? Is that the capitalist model we've been sold? That, you know, we give the money to the people who know how to distribute, to work with it, and they're going to create jobs, and we'll all be okay. Is it what I was sold? It is capitalism kicking us right in the butt. That's what it is. And when you start to question this stuff, and you start to think of all these millions and billions of dollars we're handing out to these corporations, where are the jobs? They're going to China. They're going to India. They're going out of this country. So when we give money to these very wealthy people, they want more money. And they use the money that we've given them to create more for themselves, not for us. You know, we used to think, you know, 1960s mentality. You give the company some the resource, they're going to build the plant, they're going to create more jobs, they're going to create more product. It's going to be good for everybody. That's not how things are done anymore. You give them the money, they automate, they kick you out of work, and they raise the price anyway. That's what they do. It's angering. Let's take a quick break. Right back. If you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. Stitcher on the smartphone. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Thanks for being here. Right back with Hour 2. Stick around.
Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
You are demanding that this city will respect the dignity of labor. Not only Memphis, but you are reminding the nation that it is a crime for people to live in this rich nation and receive starvation wages.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. speaking in Memphis, Tennessee. As the nation commemorates a civil rights icon today, his words resonate far beyond the scope of civil rights. Dr. King was killed supporting the rights of striking sanitation workers in Memphis, Tennessee. He said in his writings that he leaned more towards socialist than capitalist economic beliefs, and he was anti-war. After civil rights victories, he said he wanted to march on poverty. Labor unions marched with Dr. King and came to his aid when he needed it. Dr. King said the civil rights movement and labor has identical needs. Decent wages, fair working conditions, livable housing, and old age security. And he warned even then against the so-called right-to-work laws being pushed by anti-union, anti-worker politicians today. He said we must guard against being fooled by false slogans like right-to-work. He called it a law to rob us of our civil rights and job rights. Its purpose, he said, is to destroy labor unions and the freedom of collective bargaining by which unions have improved the wages and working conditions of everyone. In Memphis today, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference is supporting locked-out Kellogg's workers with a march as part of the King Day actions. David Durkee, president of the Bakers Union, BCTGM, will lead the march and speak. 220 workers have been locked out by Kellogg's since October. The multi-billion-dollar profitable company locked out the workers after demanding that they agree to concessions that would create a casual part-time workforce. The union says the company wants to replace steady middle-class full-time jobs with casual part-time employees who would make significantly lower wages and substandard benefits. Barely 2 weeks into his first term, and New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio is moving on a paid sick leave ordinance for city workers. It would extend paid sick days to 360,000 New York workers who don't have them now. He announced the move, saying that City Hall is going to be on the side of working families all over the city. The new law would require that businesses with more than five employees provide five paid sick days each year. This proposal would never have made it past former Mayor Mike Bloomberg, but the new mayor and a more progressive city council makes this and other pro-worker actions possible now in New York City. To support Workers Independent News, you can donate now at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Voter ID, which is going to allow Governor Romney to win the state of Pennsylvania. Done.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. You know, back in 1961, Dr. King said that in our glorious fight for civil rights, we must guard against being fooled by false slogans such as right to work. It is a law to rob us of our civil rights and job rights. It is supported by Southern segregationists who try to keep us from achieving our civil rights and our rights of equal job opportunity. Its purpose is to destroy labor unions and the freedom of collective bargaining by which unions have improved wages and working conditions for everyone. He went on to say, wherever these laws have been passed, wages are lower, opportunities are fewer, and there are no civil rights. He said, we do not intend to let them do this to us. We demand this fraud be stopped. Our weapon is our vote. And I look at this governor, and I look at Mike Terzai, and I look at the Republicans here in Pennsylvania who pushed this fraud of a voter suppression law through to take that weapon away. And thank goodness, for now, it has been ruled unconstitutional, which is why we've asked our good friend Attorney Irwin Aronson to come talk to us about the ruling and also about this day. Irwin, thanks for taking time for us.
Good to be here, particularly on this day.
You know, I look at that statement, we demand this fraud be stopped, our weapon, our vote.
How so many years later could we improve upon that statement? It is the essence. Some people have described in the context of the voter identification legislation, the photo ID law that we have finally overturned after two long and very painful years of this most precious of rights being held in the balance. And people have described it as a fundamental right, and I've challenged that. And I think I've challenged it even on this show. It's not a fundamental right. It is the foundational right of our system. It is what sets us apart from every other country. It is the bedrock, the foundation of democracy. And here in Pennsylvania, that foundation of democracy has been under assault. And thank goodness we had our opportunity to have a chance to be heard. And we were heard in court. And under the leadership of the Pennsylvania AFL-CIO and its officers, Rick Bloomingdale and Frank Snyder, The Pennsylvania AFL-CIO and the Pennsylvania labor movement was heard loud and clear in the courtroom, and we participated shoulder to shoulder with the ACLU, with the NAACP, with the League of Women Voters, with the Advancement Project, with several very, very courageous plaintiffs who stood up to this tyranny by their own government aimed at stripping him of this most foundational of all rights. And we won. And we won in rather stark fashion, where Judge McGinley, in a 103-page decision, has laid out with clarity that this effort at imposing a solution for a problem that nobody could identify was an essential and basic impingement on this foundational constitutional right, on this right to vote of this Commonwealth. And that it came down this past Friday as we were entering the recognition for Dr. King, the celebration of the anniversary of his birth, it couldn't have been any more timely.
I agree. Now, I see a lot of the right-wing groups screaming and carrying on that Corbett has not, as I understand, has not come out and said that they're going to appeal. I'm curious your thoughts on the potential of an appeal and where that might take us.
Well, obviously, I'm not party to the counsel that takes place in the governor's office, so I don't know. As much as they've spent of our taxpayer money in trying to implement this ever-moving target of this voter suppression law that they call voter identification, I certainly wouldn't be shocked or surprised if they do indeed file an appeal to the Supreme Court, and they have that right under our system to seek an appeal to the Supreme Court, of Pennsylvania. And all I can say is that I would, if there is an appeal, much rather be defending this decision of Judge McGinley in the Commonwealth Court than challenging it.
Right. Because I look at it, I mean, I look at all of the money that we've wasted. And, you know, earlier on in the program we talked.
But we haven't wasted. The governor's wasted our money. It hasn't been us wasting any money.
Thank you for the clarification. But all the money that has been wasted, that could have been spent on education, could have been spent on you know, roads and bridges and investments in our future.
Could have been spent on delivering some health care to people.
Exactly.
Access. Feeding some children. Something. Democracy works at.
I'm with you. And, you know, the question is, you know, you look at all of this money that we spent on this and every other misadventure that they've gone after, and at what point do we, the voters, start saying, enough already?
Well, I think that we're saying it right now, and I think that one of the wonderful things about our system is that if you push people long enough and hard enough and far enough, they push back, and they push back with the tools that they have at their hands. And the tool that they have at their hands that was most plainly enshrined in this decision of the Commonwealth Court is the tool of our right to vote. And we're going to get that opportunity. We're going to get that opportunity this spring in the primary election season. We're going to get that opportunity again this fall in the general election season. We know that Governor Corbett plans on being on the ballot, and we have a chance to step up to the plate with our right to vote protected, with our right to vote secure, with our right to vote that makes each of us equal. Each one of us has exactly one vote, whether it is one among the wonderful individual plaintiffs in the case that we just won, or it's one of the Koch brothers who is attempting to impose their outsider views on our little state here in Pennsylvania. We all have one vote, and it equalizes us, and we can use it. We can exercise it. And Judge McGinley laid the foundation for us once again to recognize that our votes are supreme to everything.
And that's a good thing. You know, and I want to go back and, you know, with today being Martin Luther King Day, and, you know, kind of get your thoughts. You know, I've taken the position that, you know, it was much more, you know, because I've asked people, you know, what do you think? What are you saying? And it mostly comes down to he was a civil rights leader who fought for civil rights and gave a good speech. And I'm of the mindset it's so much more than that. I'm just curious what, in your way, you know, what your thoughts were.
I think he was, and dedicated a life to being the voice and the heart of justice in this country, of the true justice that we all were taught about in our ninth grade civics class. This fundamental and, again, foundational notion of equality, of fairness. This was somebody who didn't say, let's revolutionize by burning and fighting and terroring. This was somebody who said, let's stand up and recognize that there's no justice for anyone until there's justice for everyone. A legacy, indeed, of the most essential notions of American patriotism. And I think Martin Luther King was a true patriot, despite the fact that my government treated him as if he was a subversive. He was the truest of patriots. And I'm honored to have live part of my life in the shadow of his ideas and his willingness to use the force of his ideas, the force of ideas, to change our country in the most basic and fundamental of ways into a part of the nation that its founding documents describe, that all men are created equal, that all people are created equal. And that we're endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, rights that can't be given away or taken away. And Dr. King stood for that. We're all better for it.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. What do you think of this? I've been seeing the right in this country doing an awful lot of, in my view, rewriting history. I hear a bunch of speeches, you know, trying to change him into this some kind of raging conservative. I'm curious your thought.
My thought is it's pure lunacy, rank political opportunism seasoned with lunacy. And with all due respect to those, and I'm going to be the first guy that defends everybody's right to speak their minds, truly an abomination and a perversion of the memory of a true great American patriot. You know, I could say it any number of ways, but I can't think of a better one than that.
No.
And somebody as well whose religious beliefs stood as a guide, not that he wore them necessarily on his sleeve, but somebody who recognized the true Christian values, Judeo-Christian values, humanitarian values of our society, without imposing religion on anybody, but recognizing that our religious beliefs demand certain basic and fundamental truths about the way we treat one another. And these right-wing ideologues who are attempting now to hijack this memory and this symbol really deserve to be repudiated in the most basic of ways and in the most open and fundamental and notorious of ways as well.
Yeah, I'm with you. You know, as we move down the road, I've seen a lot of articles today on the dream not realized and, you know, the unrealized dream and tons of stuff on this. I'm curious, you know, as you look back over the years and you look at, you know, what the dream was or what you think the dream was, are we anywhere near it? Are we on the right path? Wrong path? Thoughts?
Well, there is an old and well-known, often repeated Talmudic pronouncement that your question brings to mind for me again, and that is that it's not our job to every goal, to reach every goal, but it's our job to get started in the battle. It's not our job to raise every forest, but it is our job to plant the tree. And there is so, so very much yet to be accomplished. The path that we have been directed in politically of late is certainly frustrating and scary, and yes, there's an attempt to rewrite history. And absolutely, there are times when we're compelled to fight over struggles that we believed were long ago won. But the fact of the matter is that this is an extraordinarily better country and an extraordinarily better society than the one in which Dr. King grew up. And it's better in large measure because of the courage of his willingness to step up and speak out and to use his many gifts to encourage and embolden people to step forward, to pursue their own rights, to pursue their own education, to pursue their voting rights, to pursue their careers, to pursue their dreams, to live out that great statement of this country's founding document, that we have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So while on a day-to-day basis, people like me, and I've expressed this many times to you both on the show and privately in conversations, I am breathtakingly frustrated by so many things that I see that I genuinely believe shouldn't be. And I, as I get older, I have the impatience, of course, of somebody in his older years, even though I have a great deal of energy. My patience grows thinner day by day as I see people trying to steal our freedoms and hijack our ideas and wrest from us, in many respects, the American dream. All that having been said, we are so much better than we were in my childhood. I remember a day when I was the ripe old age of 5 years old, living in Pittsburgh, not in the Deep South, and there's a place that Pittsburghers know well still today called Kennywood Park. And back in my young childhood in the 1950s, Kennywood Park had a swimming pool, a public pool that you could pay 50 cents or a buck to go swim for the day. And the pool had a rope through it, not quite in the middle. One side was actually divided off a little, good bit smaller than the other, held up by buoys. And on one side, the smaller side, was the black side of the pool, and on the other side was the white side of the pool. And as I say, this was not in the Deep South. This was not Alabama or Mississippi. This was Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
And I remember my pop taking me there on a Saturday with my picture ending up on the front page of the old Pittsburgh Sun-Telegraph the next day, the Sunday there, right after that, because in my father's world, it was time for a little bit of justice. So we went swimming that day, and I was the first white kid on the black side of that pool. And but for people like Dr. King and people like my dad, who were willing to step up, we would still have swimming pools, not merely in Mississippi and Alabama and Arkansas, maybe Tennessee or Texas or Florida, or Georgia or South Carolina, but right here in Pennsylvania, that had this ridiculous notion of separate but equal. That's gone. We no longer legally have black neighborhoods and white neighborhoods, although we know that those kinds of things still exist. We no longer legally have black schools and white schools, although they're trying real hard with the so-called charter schools to reimpose that very kind of notion on us in a very different way, but with the same result. So all in all, things are much better than they were, and not as good as they could be. And we're on our path, and we're exercising democracy. And Judge McGinley this past week, in shooting down, in striking, in declaring the obvious unconstitutionality of the Pennsylvania voter ID law, once again struck a blow, a legal blow, a peaceful blow, but a blow nonetheless to those who would undermine what we have progressed to. So I think it's better, and I think that I'm happy to be engaged in the struggle to make it even better. And I think that everybody that I'm blessed to work with is in the same vein, literally, every day. And it's a proud heritage. And it's a heritage that I genuinely love to get up and go to work at every day. And I know you do, too.
And I do. And I'm glad that you're here. And, you know, I appreciate the story. And, you know, I'm of the same mindset. There are things that we need to be working on and coming together over, not being divided and pulled apart by. But I appreciate your thoughts and your stories. Irwin, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate the time.
I appreciate being here. Thanks a lot, Rick. And thanks for featuring this particular issue on this particular day. Very, very timely.
Thanks
very,
so much.
Very.
Let's take a quick break. Back with your thoughts, questions, comments, whatever's on your mind. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
The rich truly are different from you and me. They tend to become Congress critters. You don't find many plumbers, mine workers, dirt farmers, Walmart associates, beauty parlor operators, taxi drivers, or other get-the-job-done Americans among the 535 members of the U.S. House and Senate. What you do find is an oversupply of lawmakers drawn from a very thin strata of America's population. Millionaires. The Center for Responsive Politics reports that last year, for the first time in history, more than half of our senators and House members are in the Millionaires Club. Indeed, the average net worth, the value of what they own minus what they owe, for all lawmakers now totals more than $7 million each. The world in which our representatives live is light years from where the majority of people live. And the divide between the governors and the governees is especially stark for the 40% of people whose net worth is zero, or technically less than zero, since their income and other assets are far exceeded by their debts. This widening chasm is not just a matter of wealth, but most significantly, a literal separation of the privileged few from the experiences, needs, and aspirations of the many, who are struggling to make ends meet and worried that opportunities for their children to get ahead are no longer available to them. This is Jim Hightower saying, the harsh reality is that most Americans are no longer represented in Washington. Chances are that their own members of Congress don't know any struggling and worried people, share nothing in common with them, and can't relate to their real-life needs. Thus, Congress is content to play ideological games with such basics as health care, minimum wage, joblessness, food stamps, and Social Security. America's wealth divide has become a chasm, creating a looming social and political crisis for America that undermines any pretense that ours is a democratic society.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
I am so pleased to be your governor. And I ask you to give me your support as I run for governor again, because I am running for governor of Pennsylvania.
Hit the road, Jack. Don't you come back no more, no more, no more, no more. Hit the road, Jack. And don't you come back no more.
What you say?
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick, at therickSmithShow.com. So it was today, back in 1934, the Nazis adopted the Act on the Regulation of National Labor. The idea was, you know, you got to attack attack collective bargaining. You got to attack people having a voice. Make that illegal. What they did is they replaced independently negotiated contracts, the collective bargaining agreements that each union had with the people that the companies that they worked for, did away with those, got rid of them, and replaced them with an act that in part read, the leader of the plant makes the decisions for the employees and the laborers in all matters concerning the enterprise. He is responsible for the well-being of the employees and the laborers. They owe him faithfulness. You know, I look at what's going on, and look, I'm not quite saying yet that the Republicans pushing this stuff are Nazis. I'm not saying that, but fascists? Come and look at what is. When you have a melding of government and business for the interest of business, when you've got the government saying we need to be business friendly, we've got to work in partnership. This is the conservative view, that government is there to promote business. This sounds an awful lot like the fascist past. And if you go back and you read Pastor Niemöller's famous poem about first they came for the trained unionists. No, I think it was first they came for the communists, and I wasn't a communist, said nothing. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I said nothing. Because they didn't go after the Jews right away. They ran after everybody else, anybody else who would be willing to stand up for them. And there was all those communists, and there was all those union people, and there's all them, and them, and them, and them. And they picked and picked and picked, and everybody else rallied around, yeah, thank goodness it's not us. Yeah, go after them. Until eventually, as Pastor Niemöller points out, it is us. And I'm kind of saying that right now as we look at what's going on with this push towards destroying people's ability to collectively bargain, with people's ability to have a voice on the job. I'm saying, yeah, you know what? It looks a whole lot like 1934, where they're trying to do away with the only people who can stand in their way. And if you look at here in Pennsylvania, you go back and you think about who stopped the privatization of the wine and spirits shops so far? Well, it's been the unions. Who stopped the privatization of the lottery? Oh, it was the unions. Who stopped a lot of the really ugly, bad stuff that this governor and these Republicans have been trying to do by selling off all of our assets and handing out huge, huge rewards to a few? Who's been there to do that? The members of the labor unions. Which is why that there's an all-out attack going on, not just here in Pennsylvania, but all across the country. And as I said last week, you know, you look at this statement by the Missouri ALEC co-chair, a guy named Ed Emery, the state senator there, where he said, look, understand it. He says, quote, one of the things that will be advocated by the unions is look at all these right-to-work states. Average wages all go down. He says, sure, they'll go down. You have a whole lot more people working in those states, and they ain't necessarily working for $25 an hour. Couldn't get jobs at $25 an hour, but they can get it at 20 because they're worth 20, and they couldn't get it at 17 or they're worth 12. So all of a sudden, he says, you have a whole lot more people working, which in my view, if you have everybody working, the supply of labor, understanding back to economics, the X charts, back to economics 101, so the scarcity of supply raises prices because, you know, people demand, they're going to demand labor. So as the economy tightens and labor pool tightens, wages go up, but not in his world. He says, you won't find in any of those states that those workers were employed, UNAS, that their wages have gone down. So he's saying, look, the wages don't go down in unionized states. We know that. And they're going to go down when you pass right to work. We know that. But it's no longer about your right to have a job. It's about freedom. You should have the freedom to work for pennies. You should have the freedom not to have health care. You should have the freedom not to have any retirement. You should have the freedom to have to work until you drop dead. That's basically what he's saying. Even though every study, every reputable study that you come across says, look, these laws are bad for your state. They're bad for workers. And even in the places that have been the conservative paradises, like Idaho and Oklahoma, where they said, oh, you know, we passed right to work and things got so much better. When you take an honest look at it, not so much. So this whole push for this nonsensical right to work is all about what? Well, in my view, it's about more for those at that one tenth of 1%. Those 400 people at the top. The ones who are funding all of this. And go back to understand, yeah, okay, the money's about making more money. How are they doing it? Are they doing it by producing goods? I mean, back in the old days, we'd say, well, we'll give them tax breaks and we'll give them money so that they can build on, add on to the factory. And that by adding on to the factory, they're going to add jobs. Or they're going to add on to their business and create more jobs so that they make more products and sell more stuff. And you have this snowballing up where the workers do better, the company does better, consumers do better with more opportunities. But that isn't what's going on here. What's going on here is they're taking this money, they're investing it in politicians and in media campaigns and in slogan bumper sticker slogans, convincing us, oh, you don't need that. Lowering wages, destroying conditions, and pocketing the difference. That's how they're making their money. They're making their money by taking it from you, not by creating a better widget, not by building a bigger factory. No. But by taking it from you and me and every other person who works for a living. That's it. Bottom line. Simple stuff. And this latest piece of poison being pushed in our General Assembly here in Pennsylvania, Senate Bill 1034, and House Bill 1507, just the latest in the Alec playbook, the latest in the Koch brother playbook, the latest in the Chamber of Commerce playbook. And when we come back, we're going to talk with Joe Davis, president of Local 1408 of the United Steelworkers out in North Versailles, Pennsylvania. Stick around. We're right back. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
You are demanding that this city will respect the dignity of labor. Not only Memphis, but you are reminding the nation that it is a crime for people to live in this rich nation and receive starvation wages.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. speaking in Memphis, Tennessee. As the nation commemorates a civil rights icon today, his words resonate far beyond the scope of civil rights. Dr. King was killed supporting the rights of striking sanitation workers in Memphis, Tennessee. He said in his writings that he leaned more towards socialist than capitalist economic beliefs, and he was anti-war. After civil rights victories, he said he wanted to march on poverty. Labor unions marched with Dr. King and came to his aid when he needed it. Dr. King said the civil rights movement and labor has identical needs. Decent wages, fair working conditions, livable housing, and old age security. And he warned even then against the so-called right-to-work laws being pushed by anti-union, anti-worker politicians today. He said we must guard against being fooled by false slogans like right to work. He called it a law to rob us of our civil rights and job rights. Its purpose, he said, is to destroy labor unions and the freedom of collective bargaining by which unions have improved the wages and working conditions of everyone. In Memphis today, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference is supporting locked-out Kellogg's workers with a march as part of the King Day actions. David Durkee, president of the Bakers Union, BCTGM, will lead the march and speak. 220 workers have been locked out by Kellogg's since October. The multi-billion-dollar profitable company locked out the workers after demanding that they agree to concessions that would create a casual part-time workforce. The union says the company wants to replace steady middle-class full-time jobs with casual part-time employees who would make significantly lower wages and substandard benefits. Barely 2 weeks into his first term, and New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio is moving on a paid sick leave ordinance for city workers. It would extend paid sick days to 360,000 New York workers who don't have them now. He announced the move, saying that City Hall is going to be on the side of working families all over the city. The new law would require that businesses with more than 5 employees provide 5 paid sick days each year. This proposal would never have made it past former Mayor Mike Bloomberg, but the new mayor and a more progressive city council makes this and other pro-worker actions possible now in New York City. To support Workers Independent News, you can donate now at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. So, you know, I got to tell you, I love that new frame. And I'm mark my words, put it on the calendar. Right to work is going to go the way of yesterday. We're going to start hearing more of freedom to work because the right has figured out, like I said, they figured out that there are no rights there and certainly no work. So they've got to change the message again. And that's what I think this Ed Emery was doing. I think this was that trial balloon to throw it out there and see what people had to say and the thoughts that would be behind that. But here in Pennsylvania, 3 years ago, we were sleeping on the floor of the Capitol in Wisconsin saying, look, folks, get ready. All of the Koch brother Alex-style right-to-work attack on labor coming our way. Well, here it is in the form of House Bill 1507 and Senate Bill 1034. And here to talk a little bit about it, I got Joe Davis. He's the president of Local 1408, the U.S. Steelworkers, United Steelworkers, out of North Versailles, Pennsylvania. Joe, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, I appreciate it. I appreciate you having me.
You know, I go back to 2011, the attacks in Wisconsin, all of the stuff that came out of that. And I remember saying, Joe, that, you know, get ready because it's coming our way. Well, here they are. Now, this may not be the full-blown attack that happened in Wisconsin, but for Pennsylvania, this is huge.
Yeah, you're correct. And this is the sad thing about it on these two bills. It does nothing for the state of Pennsylvania. I'm going to go over, if you don't mind, I'd like to go over a few little thoughts that I have.
Throw them at me.
And we can go with that.
Yeah, hit me with it.
Okay. First off, the legislation has nothing to do with protecting anyone's their paycheck. When we do a contract, we negotiate to have the union dues and all the other taxes taken out of their paycheck. What these two bills are saying right now is we don't want you taking out the union dues. Well, they've got to understand the companies, the municipalities, the sewage authorities that I represent, they already have the equipment. They already have this stuff already set up. It doesn't cost them a dime more to do what they're doing already. And I've been with this local for 22 years. And we've never had a problem. I've never had a company say, hey, Joe, we've got to find a different way of taking union dues and this out and this out. And
so what you're saying, Joe, is in the private sector, it's not, no one's crying that it's so expensive, because one of the key arguments that the right is making, that the people pushing this poison are perpetrating on the taxpayers here in Pennsylvania, is that somehow this is going to save money and it's going to balance our budget. It's going to help. Anything in this that's going to save us a dime?
You know what? It's not costing them, but 4.5 cents, if that, per person. When they do it on a group, like I'm going to take a sewage authority. I have 17 people down there. It might cost the sewage authority 1.5 cents per person once a month. I'm talking once a month. So if you figure it out, that's 15 cents a year.
So you could, sitting at the bargaining table, if you're the employer, you could go, you know, I'd like my 15 cents. And maybe, hey, just for the convenience, double what it would cost us so I can make a penny on it. So it would be like 30 cents a year.
And usually that doesn't even come up. It really doesn't, because they understand we give a little, they give a little. And this is an understanding way back probably before, well, when the United Steelworkers first came about. Everybody understands that the company collects the money. It's not an issue of collecting. It's these people who think that every time, and I'm speaking of these people that are coming after us with this, that's saying it's costing all this money, costing all this money, but it's actually not costing us that much. But the reasoning is they think that the union is taking, let's say if we take out $20 for union dues, they think we're spending $15 on the political end. It doesn't work that way. Every dime goes to the local membership for negotiating
and
for arbitration.
Enforcing the contract. And that. So let me, out of the dues dollar that each teacher or firefighter or cop or union member spends, how much of the dues money do you spend on politics?
Well, now we spend nothing. It's volunteered.
So all of the money that is spent on politics.
Right now, under my contract, if your dues is, let's say, 4.35, every bit goes back into negotiating and arbitration. We do not take any of that money out for political action.
And legally, you can't.
Correct. Only way that we get political action money, which is PAC, let's put it in the right words, the PAC PAC money, is that we make a donation.
Right.
Now, let's say, for example, for myself, if I want to give $25 per month, per year, you know, for the whole year, I can do that. But it's on a volunteer basis. We're not going into paycheck and say, you have to give this much for the PAC. And this is where these two bills, they're saying we are doing it. It's not true. It's just not true. And it's a shame because I just read somewhere, and I wished I had it, the Chamber of Commerce is a little bit, well, they're not a little bit. They are for this law.
Absolutely.
But you know what? Between me and you and the hard place, we have more things in the state of Pennsylvania to worry about than this right here because it's not broken.
Yeah, it's
not
broken.
If it was broken, I would absolutely get on your show or any other show throughout the state of Pennsylvania and say, it's broken. We need to fix it.
Yeah,
it's not broken.
Yeah, I agree with you, Joe, 100%, but this isn't about actually fixing a problem. This is being pushed by people who destroy things. These people don't actually build things. They tear things down. This is not about taxpayers. This isn't about freedom or fairness. This is about simply one thing. That's about weakening the ability of working people to have a say on the job and to be able to share in the profits. That's what it's about. It's about bringing your voice and making sure that there's no opposition. I've taken the position, this is very Machiavellian, this is the Chamber of Commerce, the Koch brothers, the wealth class of this country, gutting workers in public. Because they can. To me, that's what it is.
And you're absolutely right. Because if we let these two bills go through, see, you got to understand, and I'm going to be honest with you, I came from a right-to-work state.
And did you get any work?
Wages.
Did you get any work? Did you have any rights? Because we keep hearing that.
No, absolutely not. You
because
have none.
Most people, Joe, tell me, well, I should have the right to work. And I go, I agree with you. And if right to work actually gave you the right to a job, I would be 100% behind it. If it gave you any rights, I would be behind it. Sad reality is there are neither rights nor work.
No. And again, I'm going to state from my experience. I came from a state, and I'll say the state of Florida, we had no rights. And I'm telling you, I picked oranges till my hands bled. Did anybody take care of me or give me my workers' rights? Absolutely not. They don't protect their people down there like we do here in the state of Pennsylvania. We protect our people, the farmers, the steel mill people. If a person in a steel mill gets hurt, our union dues, we run up there and we help that man. We go over and aboard what the federal government even allows. We go in, we help our people. And every dollar, that's what aggravates me the most about the whole thing. Every dollar of the union money, from my local, I'm speaking of my local, we spend on our people. We make sure we take care of them. We give them education classes. And, yes, we do political. We go out and help our people that helped us. Yes, we do. But it's on a volunteer basis. These companies that's running around here say they spend the union dues on this. It's wrong. We're not doing it.
I'm right there with you. But, you know, what they have on their side, while we may have the reality of the truth and all that on the side of people who want to stand up and defend workers' rights, what they've got is they've got Madison Avenue. They've got PR firms who focus group test their bumper sticker slogans to get people thinking that, oh, there's something there that's not, like right to work, where we know there's no rights, there's no work. And this thing that we're talking about, they're calling it paycheck protection. Yet I can't find what's being protected. Does it protect people from getting their wages stolen? Wage theft cases, is there anything in this that you know of?
No, this has nothing to do with their paycheck. As I said in the beginning, everything is automated now. You and I know everything's run by computer system. So it doesn't cost them, again, nothing.
Yeah, I understand that, Joe, but what I'm asking.
About this here that people should know.
Hit me.
You can opt out anytime you want to. You can opt out.
That kind of throws a wrench into their whole argument, doesn't it?
It kills their argument. It kills their argument, and I cannot understand our state senators. State senators have got to realize you just can't protect, let's say, Harrisburg. Your job is to protect the whole state of Pennsylvania. I don't care if you're from Harrisburg or out in Erie, out in Punxsutawney. Wherever you are a state senator, your job is to protect the whole state of Pennsylvania. And whoever voted you in, that's your responsibility, just not to them people, but the whole state of Pennsylvania. And I think that's what a lot of our state representatives have forgot.
Yeah, I think they're more interested in protecting the Grover Norquist, the Koch
Absolutely.
Brothers,
the Marcella Shale drillers. The Commonwealth Foundation and the Tea Party brokers and all these other guys running around here. The unions, this union, that, they've got to understand. We are working people. We're the middle class people right now. We want a good, decent wage. We're not asking to be wealthy like they are. We're asking just for a decent living wage that we can live on and feed our family and send our kids to schools like they do.
I'm right there with you. And I go back to this euphemistically named piece of legislation, basically funneled to us by the good folks at the American Legislative Exchange Council, Alec, that they euphemistically call paycheck protection. And as you've said, there's no protection in there against wage theft. Is there any protection in there against the theft of overtime or making you work through your breaks or working in unsafe conditions or anything in that that's going to help you actually protect, get any protection at all?
There's not. There's nothing in there that I've seen. That means that, really, and what they're going to do, and this is why where the right to work comes in, they're going to sneak this in, and they're not fooling nobody. They're going to sneak it in. They're going to say, no, we're not all for that. But when you look at it, when you work over 40 hours, let's say 48 hours, we're going to give you that on comp time.
Yeah.
But with me and you, you've heard about comp time.
Sure.
You don't get paid that half no more. That means your family goes hungry for a couple of days a week. They don't understand. The people in the mills, where my units are, the police, your police officer, your firemen, they work a lot of overtime sometimes, especially in these the cold weather right now. Firemen might work 12, 14 hours a day before he gets to go home to his family. He needs that overtime to make sure his family has food on the table, electricity, the gas. They got to understand, all this money is brought back in to the state of Pennsylvania.
So
it's not like we're shipping our money out of Pennsylvania to buy the gas. We're buying our own gas.
So you mean
people
the,
don't realize it. We
you
are.
You mean the local
our
teacher?
Own gas that is produced in Pennsylvania, natural gas,
right.
Put it that way. Natural gas.
So what you're saying is we don't have many teachers or cops or firefighters or steel workers, for that matter, shipping their money into offshore accounts in the Cayman Islands
Absolutely not.
No?
Absolutely not. We're shipping our money right here in Pennsylvania. The teachers, they put their money back in the school system because when they pay their taxes and everything, it goes back into the school system. We're educating another group of students to do the same thing. People better realize, too, the more we take away from Pennsylvania, the more we're taking our young people out of Pennsylvania. We want to keep our families close to us. Might not be in the same city, but we want to keep them close. We can't do it when you've got the Chamber of Commerce and the Commonwealth Foundation and the Tea Party backers and all this other stuff keep constantly coming at us. And it's going to come to a head, and I personally see that that this is going to be an uphill battle for all of us, and I've got my unit all aware of this. Matter of fact, I sent a big stack of letters out today. We're going to fight this to the end.
So what do we do? What do our listeners do? What's the movement now forward? Because we understand that this may come up here in the next couple of months, probably not closer to the end of the year. What do we do right now? And then we'll go from there. What are you telling your folks right now?
I need everybody that's a union brother, sister, that's steel workers, teamsters, ask me, whoever you are, whatever you are, a union member, I need you to call your state representative and make sure they're on board with us. I need you to call every one of your state senators and make sure they're on board with us. And if they're not, you better let them know that we won't be standing behind them again. We'll be standing in front of them with a new opponent.
And it just isn't members. It's their families. It's their friends. It's everyone. Because, you know, as I've been saying on this program, Joe, you know, an attack on one is an attack on all of us. And if we allow one group to be attacked, eventually, you know, using the Shark Tank analogy, eventually the shark comes for us.
You're absolutely correct. So and you know what? And if we don't have the right bait to get him, we're all going to go down. But I think this time we're ready. I mean, we're ready for the fight because myself and my secretary and my executive board, we've been talking about this for months, the right to work. We were also talking about NAFTA. There's a lot of other things that's coming up that we need to be worrying about. And right now, this is our fight in Pennsylvania.
So let me ask you.
I have to fight what's in my home state right now.
I'm with you.
The federal government will go back and get it later. But right now, this is the most important thing. This is the most important fight that I think that the unions have ever had in the state of Pennsylvania. Because if they get these two passed, then what's to say they can get the right to work passed?
Yeah, and that's their hope. That's their hope. But,
absolutely.
Yeah, you brought up the federal level, and of course you were talking. I'm assuming alluding to the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. How much do you think that this is diversion? That putting these pieces of legislation in Pennsylvania now is a diversion for labor to spend all of their time fighting this, while other things go maybe unnoticed or not being fought as vehemently as it would be if this fight hadn't been there.
Well, see, they got to understand, under the rapid response that we have with the United Steelworkers, which we have an excellent rapid response, coordination, what we do, this is a big fight for us. At the federal level, we still have members out there that handle the federal level. But if it comes to a vote, we'll make sure we get 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8,000 people just from the United Steelworkers to call Washington, D.C. We don't stop at one issue. We can't. But this right now, I know this is on the minds of every Pennsylvania that's hearing us. This has to be fought now.
Yep.
If we don't fight this now, again, they need to call their state representatives and we need to call our state senators. Do not overlook this. If you go to church, which everybody does, pretty much everybody. If you don't, that's fine, but I'm not going to bring that in here. But talk to those people.
Yep.
Tell them, if we take away from Pennsylvania, then we take away from everything else. They don't realize. Do you understand? Every job lost in Pennsylvania, we could lose a farm. We could lose another gas well. Every time we lose something here, there's a recourse to that. But I don't think the Chamber of Commerce does their homework as well as we do locally here. Because when I lose a store, what did I lose? I lost 100 people, plus I've lost probably 100 people that's going to leave that area. There's no tax base there.
Yep.
Now, my, everything starts dropping.
Yeah, and the money that they would have spent at other establishments, which could mean, you know, it's a spiraling down.
It's a trickle effect.
Yeah, once you lose one good-size employer, that's revenue out of the economy, that the local economy that's now gone, which means more layoffs. It's a spiraling down, and the sad reality is I don't think the people, the Chamber of Commerce and the rest, I don't think they care. They have their ideology. They want what they want, and what they want is total and absolute control of working people, not just in this state but in this entire country, and this is the first step to getting it in this state. Joe Davis, I appreciate the time. Thank you for your fight, and we look forward to talking to you again at some point in the near future.
Okay, I appreciate you having me, and just my last final word, if I may.
Hit me.
Please get out, call your state representative and state senator, and tell them vote no on House Bill 1507 and Senate Bill 1034.
And do like Harry Truman said, give them hell. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Your proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can give me an email, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Randall sent me an email during the break. He says, not quite fascist yet, but probably proto-fascist. He says, it's strange because most of our grandfathers killed fascists for a living, so I wonder if they were alive today, if they would have gone after us. Good question. I know my grandfather would have. Not all that. I can't imagine. How he is spinning. Some horrible news out in Omaha. Today there was a plant explosion that at this point what they're reporting are two people were killed, four more seriously critically injured, and several more injured in the explosion. And what's interesting is the way the report looks is OSHA was on the scene investigating the part of the plant that collapsed. The stories go that in the last 40 years, OSHA had issued 35 violations to this company, International Nutrition Incorporated. They're a company that makes, feed and things for livestock. They claim that someone was on premises, and according to the report back in 2013, they were fined $10,000, after a lengthy investigation found six violations, including two related to electrical safety standards. But we don't need no stinking regulation. We don't need those overseers there. We love our freedom water and our collapsing buildings. Sad. My heart goes out to the families. You know, it's just horrible. Horrible, horrible. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, ricksmithshow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast, Stitcher on the smartphone. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back with hour three. Stick around.
The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
You are demanding that this city will respect the dignity of labor. Not only Memphis, but you are reminding the nation that it is a crime for people to live in this rich nation and receive starvation wages.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. speaking in Memphis, Tennessee. As the nation commemorates a civil rights icon today, his words resonate far beyond the scope of civil rights. Dr. King was killed supporting the rights of striking sanitation workers in Memphis, Tennessee. He said in his writings that he leaned more towards socialist than capitalist economic beliefs, and he was anti-war. After civil rights victories, he said he wanted to march on poverty. Labor unions marched with Dr. King and came to his aid when he needed it. Dr. King said the civil rights movement and labor has identical needs. Decent wages, fair working conditions, livable housing, and old age security. And he warned even then against the so-called right-to-work laws being pushed by anti-union, anti-worker politicians today. He said we must guard against being fooled by false slogans like right-to-work. He called it a law to rob us of our civil rights and job rights. Its purpose, he said, is to destroy labor unions and the freedom of collective bargaining by which unions have improved the wages and working conditions of everyone. In Memphis today, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference is supporting locked-out Kellogg's workers with a march as part of the King Day actions. David Durkee, president of the Bakers Union, BCTGM, will lead the march and speak. 220 workers have been locked out by Kellogg's since October. The multi-billion-dollar profitable company locked out the workers after demanding that they agree to concessions that would create a casual part-time workforce. The union says the company wants to replace steady middle-class full-time jobs with casual part-time employees who would make significantly lower wages and substandard benefits. Barely 2 weeks into his first term, and New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio is moving on a paid sick leave ordinance for city workers. It would extend paid sick days to 360,000 New York workers who don't have them now. He announced the move, saying that City Hall is going to be on the side of working families all over the city. The new law would require that businesses with more than 5 employees provide 5 paid sick days each year. This proposal would never have made it past former Mayor Mike Bloomberg. But the new mayor and a more progressive city council makes this and other pro-worker actions possible now in New York City. To support Workers Independent News, you can donate now at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Something is happening in our world. The masses of people are rising up. And wherever they are assembled today, whether they are in Johannesburg, South Africa, Nairobi, Kenya, Accra, Ghana, New York City, Atlanta, Georgia, Jackson, Mississippi, or Memphis, Tennessee, the cry is always the same. We want to be free.
Call up the Coast Guard, send up the flare. The iceberg's coming, no one cares. So I won't go down to the company town.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. You know, on Martin Luther King Day, I remember picking up my daughter, and you know, from preschool, and her giving me, and we go through this ritual every day when I pick her up from preschool of you know, what did you do today? What did you learn? And it's always, hey, you know, this is what I made. Here's you know, here's the paper plate with the cotton balls taped to it and the smiley face and all that, or here's, you know, this bit of writing that I did, or here's the book that I'm reading. On Martin Luther King Day, though, she came out and she said, we talked about Martin Luther King. And I said, well, what'd you learn? She goes, well, I didn't learn anything. I got to teach the class. I taught them. And it goes back to our tour when we went across the country. I took the whole family on the People's Tour for America as part of our radio program, and we got to go to Memphis. It was one of the stops. And we went to the place where the assassination, the murder happened. We got to see a statue. We went through some of the historical things. And my 5-year-old is teaching the group of 5-year-olds that she's in preschool with about, he was in Memphis to help workers there, the sanitation workers. And I got to see the statue, and we stood on the place where he got shot, and, you know, all of this stuff. And I was just amazed at how much she retained from the tour. So what I wanted to do, and I wanted to go back and play a couple of the interviews that really stuck with me. And in the book, the People's Tour for America book, there's a chapter on the two Johnsons and the two guys we're going to play the interviews of, that caught our attention. And what struck me is, as we're talking to one of the sanitation workers today, talking about, you know, the what brought King to Memphis and the fight for dignity and the whole I Am a Man campaign, he came out with, you know, we don't have a pension. We have no right to, we have no retirement security. We have nothing. And while King was there to fight for better wages, hours, conditions, no pension. And he had told us the story that, you know, there was a guy in his 70s. And this is what you'll hear: the guy in his 70s working on the back on a garbage truck, dropped dead because he didn't have a retirement. And now there are those who say, "Wow, he should have saved during his life." Look, these guys, while they had a union, they weren't making huge wages. Understand, this is still right to work South. This is still right to work Tennessee. This is still anti-worker country. As Zach Womp said, right to work state with lower wages and less health care. They're proud of that. In the Republican circles of the South. And what they want to bring to the northern parts and the other parts of the country, poverty, desperation. You know, which is why, in, you know, thinking about Dr. King, I wanted to go back and replay those two interviews, because now there were a bunch when we were in Memphis that grabbed me, but these were the two that really grabbed my attention. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to play the interview of the two Johnsons. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Smith Show.
The rich truly are different from you and me. They tend to become Congress critters. You don't find many plumbers, mine workers, dirt farmers, Walmart associates, beauty parlor operators, taxi drivers, or other get-the-job-done Americans among the 535 members of the U.S. House and Senate. What you do find is an oversupply of lawmakers drawn from a very thin strata of America's population, millionaires. The Center for Responsive Politics reports that last year, for the first time in history, more than half of our senators and House members are in the Millionaires Club. Indeed, the average net worth, the value of what they own minus what they owe, for all lawmakers now totals more than $7 million each. The world in which our representatives live is light years from where the majority of people live, and the divide between the governors and the governees is especially stark for the 40% of people whose net worth is zero, or technically less than zero, since their income and other assets are far exceeded by their debts. This widening chasm is not just a matter of wealth, but most significantly, a literal separation of the privileged few from the experiences, needs, and aspirations of the many who are struggling to make ends meet and worried that opportunities for their children to get ahead are no longer available to them. This is Jim Hightower saying, the harsh reality is that most Americans are no longer represented in Washington. Chances are that their own members of Congress don't know any struggling and worried people, share nothing in common with them, and can't relate to their real-life needs. Thus, Congress is content to play ideological games with such basics as health care, minimum wage, joblessness, food stamps, and Social Security. America's wealth divide has become a chasm, creating a looming social and political crisis for America that undermines any pretense that ours is a democratic society. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. PeoplesTourForAmerica.com if you want to find out where we've been, where we're going. Right there, all the information. PeoplesTourForAmerica.com. Pat, you know one of the things that caught my attention in talking with Keith Johnson, this idea that, and I wish I'd have brought it up with him, the fact that they don't have a pension. So while we're talking about saving the pensions of the public sector workers in Pennsylvania from our governor, these guys don't even have one.
Right. That's how much, you know what that makes? That we finally have a more efficient government. We don't need to steal their pension. We never let them have it.
That's an interesting way of looking at it. And here to help us talk about that and the history of AFSCME, Local 1733 here in Memphis, is Chad Johnson. He's the executive director of that local. Chad, thanks for taking time for us.
Sure, absolutely.
You know, I didn't think of it. The sanitation workers who, you know, were with the signs, I am a man.
But I have to work till I die.
Right. And that's what's happening. Unfortunately, again, I was telling you just off air, the history is that it was in 1967, year before the strike and everything, that the city came along and told the older workers, hey, by the way, there's this great new thing the government just passed. It's called Social Security.
So great new thing.
Great new. It was new then, right? So you don't have to worry about your being a part of any pension, and we'll pay all the guys who have money in the plan right now. We'll pay you out pennies on the dollar right now to take this lump sum, and you'll have Social Security.
Oh, so they stole their money then?
Exactly.
Okay.
And so as Social Security has morphed and changed over the years, it's become sometimes a trap, because by some provisions of Social Security statute, it is impossible for you to be a part of a defined pension benefit and receive Social Security at the same time. Mm-hmm. That is, unless your employer makes the Social Security payments. And most employers take one track or the other. Well, right. Now everybody's trying to take the Social Security track because, you get less benefit. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I'm working on, hopefully, by the end of this month, we will have established a supplemental retirement plan for sanitation employees in the city of Memphis, finally.
But isn't that what, you know, and I go back, and you said there a second ago, and I may need a little clarification, that you can't have both Social Security and a defined benefit plan.
Well, just so long.
Is that just public sector?
Well, yes, it's a public sector thing. Okay. Public sector, as you know, when they passed the Taft-Hartley Act in 47, changed a lot of the rules, including, you know, there's no protection for public employees to go on strike. There's no protection for public employees to deny their labor if they feel like they're being mistreated on the job. I have questions about that. I would love to be able to have the power one day to change the Taft-Hartley Act in that regard.
As would a lot of us.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the issues. I mean, this whole right-to-work thing is, you know, it's undermining our ability for freedom of association, our ability to have sovereignty over our bodies, you know. Mm-hmm. You're not supposed to live in a world where they can make you work for nothing. But unfortunately, that is some of the provisions that came with Taft-Hartley.
Isn't that the 14th Amendment?
Well, one would think, but...
Yeah. There you go.
Some places don't remember that very well.
Yeah, Taft-Hartley just sort of negated the 14th Amendment.
Well, understand. They passed it over a Harry Truman veto.
Exactly. Yes, they did.
And, you know, this was what business wanted. This was the poison pill that was going to killed the Wagner Act. I mean, and it's not just, you know, not just in the South. It's really
across
the country. And, you know, when we took this idea on of going and discovering labor's history, right, and looking across the country, you know, a lot of people are going, why would you want to go to Tennessee? You know, there's no labor history there.
There's tons of labor history.
Sounds like it's labor current events.
Well, no, but there are labor current events, but, you know,
really,
and I got to do this because I hate outing these guys, but, you know, we have stevedores. There have been stevedores, unionized stevedores in Memphis for 150 years, the Port of Memphis. there is deep labor history. I mean, Firestone used to run one of their largest plants out of Memphis years ago. Kimberly-Clark, paper producing.
Cook Brothers.
Well, now, yeah. So, yeah. But, I mean, there's a rich labor history throughout the South of these interesting pockets. Interestingly enough, the state of Alabama has a 10% labor density.
Oh, wow.
Tennessee only has 5.4. People forget Alabama has a 8% labor density. There are these pockets of these histories because of the history of manufacturing in the country throughout the South. There are these pockets. For me, those are opportunities for us to grow labor across the country. And I'm hoping now in this environment, labor understands that you can't cede any ground. Not one town, not one state,
yep.
Not one region. You have to organize everywhere.
And I have to throw something out right now. My specialty in writing and broadcast, for the most part, is poverty and homelessness. Yep. And because of labor unions the way they are, I've never had a labor union member in a homeless shelter. I have never had, so I don't have enough background to know all the words you people use. So I get to play dumb because I'm not playing.
Okay.
What is a stevedore?
That's the person who loads and unloads a ship in shipping container.
Huh.
They've been around.
Like a longshoreman?
Like hundreds of years, yeah.
Huh. These
predate longshoremen, actually.
Wow. I did not know that.
Oh,
thank you.
Yeah.
But I do think it's important to note that I have been in and out of homeless shelters all across this country. I have worked in poverty issues for about 20 years. I have never met a person with a union job in a homeless shelter.
Well, but that's the point. The point is you're supposed to have an agency, an organization that advocates for working people. Just like every other group has someone who advocates for them. Why shouldn't working people be able to come together, associate, in order to negotiate better wages and working conditions? It's simple to go.
Because it's greedy.
How is it greedy?
Is
it greedy?
Say,
I know
people.
You've already talked about this, but yeah. I got to say this. We're in a country right now where the wealth divide between the top 2% and the rest of the country is greater than between the pharaohs of Egypt and their servants.
Yeah. Sure.
So, come on.
Well,
greedy?
We're better than that. Those unions are something we needed back 100 years ago. We don't need it anymore.
Well, you need it in a time where retirement security is going out the window. You need it in a time where they're now cutting back on health care benefits. Health care at all. You need it in a time where a college education or any sort of education is slipping from the grasp of the majority of people. And me, what always confuses me is, everyone talks about Steve Jobs and Apple. Uh-huh. If unions had not existed for his father to get a prevailing wage as a plumber and for his mother to have a union job as a librarian, we would not have a Steve Jobs.
That is excellent. That is excellent.
And you wouldn't have your iPads, you wouldn't have your great iPhones, and even most of the...
And the other half of that is if Donald Trump's father hadn't been a multimillionaire, for him to lose every penny of it by being a moron... That's what happens when you're born a multimillionaire. You lose George W. Bush. Every penny.
What I ask folks, especially when I run across younger people saying they want to be rich, I said, okay, well, I want you to do your research. Find someone who's rich, right, and find out where they got their money. Because everybody knows, right, 2/3 of all the wealth is hereditary.
Right.
You know, but Ted Turner, when he was hot stuff, yes, it was sad. His father did commit suicide. That's very sad. However, his father left him 2 television stations.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a leg up. I'm gonna go on a crazy. If you're trying to build a media mogul empire,
someone handing
your father just happens to hand you stations and the broadcast rights to those stations, I think you're ahead of the game. But that's just me. I guess I'm just crazy that way. I mean, here you've got the head of AutoZone, Pitt Hyde. He did a great thing, right? He has created a brand new company. It's top of his field. He inherited most of the money from his dad. And he had to take over the family business at age 26.
Oh, poor dear.
Well, how tough.
Yeah.
Well, I look at the six Waltons who hardest days of work they've ever done was making it through the birth canal.
Yeah, exactly.
They controlled, 40% of the wealth of this country? More than the bottom 40% of the people in this country?
And so my question is, especially here in Memphis, one of the things is there's an organization here called Memphis Tomorrow. It's made up of the top CEOs of Memphis. One of the things, actually, my local, we've been talking about the last 2 years are pilots, payment in lieu of taxes. Tennessee is one of the few states that does not have a payroll tax, does not have an income tax. All we have to support our public services are property taxes and a gigantic sales tax. Interestingly enough, the state also, you would think, because I think it came out 2 weeks ago, Tennessee is the fifth, is on the list of the fifth lowest tax burden in the country. But you would think that would be enough. I'm sorry, also
you have full employment.
We're phasing out the inheritance tax. Well, my personal thing is that, you know, I'm not an economist, but to me, if low taxes meant wealth, then Tennessee should be paved in gold, right?
Right.
But it's not. And when you look at all the indicators, it's still on the bottom when it comes to poverty and women's health and children's health and education. But this group, people may not know this, but many municipalities and states, in their attempt to allegedly lure more jobs in, will say, hey, guess what? Big company, you don't have to pay the property tax, or you don't have to pay the income tax even. And then they have, to me, the bold nerve is to come around and say, oh, and by the way, we're going to form a group to tell you what to do with your public tax dollars that we're not paying. And these are the largest, FedEx does not pay property tax in the state of Tennessee.
Oh, my God, that is such a great point. These people who aren't paying taxes then try and tell you what to do with the taxes that are being paid by the little slob who just bought $80 worth of something and had to pay a sales tax on it.
Well, my slogan I've been trying to catch it on is, hey, if you don't pay, you don't get a say.
Okay.
It's real simple.
Yeah.
I mean,
And now that he's laid this out, you know, like we talked about yesterday when we went to Carlisle Tire and Wheel. I don't know if you know, but, you know, in our neighborhood, there was a manufacturing Carlisle Tire and Wheel.
Okay.
93 years in the community.
Wow.
93 years. Up and moved to Jackson, Tennessee. A $34 million welfare check your state wrote to them.
Yes.
Plus all of the things you've just said.
Right. Plus those executives are not paying any income tax, will not have to pay any inheritance taxes.
Wow.
I'm still stuck on FedEx pays on property tax.
And I've got to also say, in most of these deals that we've looked into, and it's not just us. We've been working with Greg LeRoy, runs an outfit called Good Jobs First.
Yep. We've had him on the program a number of times.
And so, you know, I mean, it's not only that they're not paying anything for this, is that they're not even paying for the infrastructure. So the municipality is forwarding the money to build all their piping, to run their sewer lines, to run their electrical lines, to pave the roads. I mean, you know, now, yes, as an individual, yeah,
that's business friendly.
That'd be a great deal.
So do you have someone in the Tennessee legislature that wants to have these corporate welfare recipients drug tested before they get their $34 million check?
I have brought it up to many of my representatives, as well as trying to reclassify them as public employees. Because if you're getting public dollars,
absolutely.
And when you look at the amount of money that's moving, these companies are getting more public dollars than people who actually work for municipalities.
Wow. And then you look at FedEx.
Do you want to run for president?
No.
But you look at FedEx. They don't even have employees. They misclassify their people as independent contractors.
Or full-time, part-time people. It's permanent part-time. That's a new thing I found when I moved down here. Permanent part-timers. So you're never going to work 40 hours. You're only going to work maybe 32. So you're never going to qualify for overtime ever.
And you're going to be permanent because you're going to make sure no one else comes to the state that can afford to hire you or would choose to. Where did you come from?
I'm originally from Philadelphia.
That explains it.
And I'm a proud Union baby. My mother was a school teacher for 34 years in the public school system. My father worked for the coroner's office picking up bodies, actually.
So I can't imagine what your mother has to think of what's going on in Philadelphia
right now. Well, yeah, she's beside herself.
The
it
education.
It is nuts that they're dismantling. They're attempting to dismantle the one thing everyone agrees you got to have, which is a good education foundation. That's how people move in society. That's where you get ideas.
There are 6-year-olds who don't want it. Let's face it. Those kids have made their decision. This is their thought.
Well, that's my other personal thing. I never trust anyone's opinion who eats paste.
That's a good
message. Well, that lets us out.
No. But, I mean, it is, and Memphis is undergoing, as I think you know, the largest school merger in the country, in the history of the country, by the city school system that actually predates almost every other school system in the state. It was founded in 1826. They decided in some political gambit to try to take over to merge with the Shelby County school system that is 30 years younger and is much smaller, about 212 schools in Memphis City school system and about 40 schools in the Shelby County school system. In the midst of this merger, they are furloughing teachers, removing teachers' aides. We've represented actually custodial workers, nutrition workers, and clerical. They have decided to privatize the custodial workers who were making an ungodly $12 an hour, how dare they, so that they can make $8 an hour and not work full-time. And these are people who are from the schools. Their children went to these schools to who knows who's going to get hired to service these areas. Wow. And all this as they reduce overall spending on education in Shelby County to the tune of a few hundred million dollars.
Well, wait a minute. Now, you have to be the most, one of the most dynamic, charismatic people I've ever had the privilege of interviewing, honest to God. If you can't change it, well, what hope do the rest of us schlubs out here have?
Well, because it's not about any one person. And that's what that's the other part I've come to understand is reminding folks, you know, our political system has turned upside down. We are waiting for politicians to tell us what to do. Mm. And I say this, we're waiting for people who spend their whole time trying to win popularity contests, spending their whole time trying to look good on television. Again, that takes time and effort. Mm-hmm. So to me, they don't have time to really think or come up with policies. We're supposed to come up with the policies. We tell the politicians, if you want to support our policies, we'll support you. We tell them what to do. They do it. If they don't, we move them out.
Term limits. We get them out.
No,
that's our term limit. You do what we say or we vote you out.
Or we vote you out.
But
that is the original term limit.
That's right.
It is the original
term limit. You messed up.
Time to go.
Do the right thing. Bye-bye.
Yep.
Right.
So let me ask you this.
These are people who buy a cheeseburger because they were advertised for 30 seconds on a commercial. Really? I mean, do you really how do we get the American people to say, I don't believe the story anymore about Big Mac, and I got to care more about actually knowing what's going on with politics?
I say this because if my grandmother, who was born in 1919, her father served in World War I, whose grandparents were ex-slaves, could tell her, go get an education, pay attention. She read the paper every day until she could no longer see. If she could do it, I think we can do it with our Xboxes, our iPhones, you know, access to more information now than in the history of the world. I know we can do it.
I'm with you. So what's it going to take? Is it going to take another general strike? I understand that's what it took to get recognition of state workers in this state. What's it going to take again?
Well, of course, as a union official, I cannot advocate a strike at any time. However, thinking, you know, just off the cuff, yes, it's going to take people standing up. It's going to take us standing up and really participating again and fighting for it. I can't fault a lot of the union folks who are at the apex of their careers now because, right, they came into unions when things were great. It was easy. You know, a union job, being a union official, meant you got to hang out all day, right? Or that's what it seemed like. Well, hey, you know, free lunch is over, folks. This is reality. We are slipping back to a feudal state or a corporate feudal state where we will be behest to corporations. We'll go back to days of corporate script. They will spy on you day and night.
They're already doing it.
Well, that's what I'm saying. That's a little tongue-in-cheek. You know, they're already doing it. We have to stand up and take it back. And it's not about any one people. I mean, to me, the other point, too, if capital can move around the world, why can't labor? You know, why don't
I make that argument all the time.
Why don't we take the tools before us and really enforce? Because I say the other thing always gets me
spoken by
is,
a man who's not in an RV with seven other people.
I had an opportunity to speak to some folks from Britain and an Australian and their unions. And you know what? They all look to the United States because even at our low union density numbers, we still have more union members in the United States than any other country. Think about that. We still have a critical mass that can move the world on these issues. That's where I take my hope from.
We just have to organize it.
We got organize. We got to organize. We got to take responsibility for ourselves. We have to, you know, stop this idolatry when it comes to money and people with wealth. Just because, I mean, wasn't Andrew Carnegie who said himself at the end of his life, look, you know, all I'm good at is making money. Some people can throw a ball. Some people can make a shelf. I'm good at making money. That does not make me better than anyone else. That is a skill to understand finance. That is a part. To me, at the end of the day, right, money is supposed to be a tool to be used towards creating a better society. Are we creating a better society by simply falling over ourselves, chasing a single dollar? Are our kids better off? Are our communities safer? Well, no. So it's time to get back to fundamentals. What is the point of money? The point of money is to be a tool to make sure that we can grow as human beings.
You're going to run for office.
No.
Yes.
No.
Play God Bless America, Brett.
No. I love God Bless America, yes, but no. No, no, no. I'd rather be in the trenches. I'd rather be...
We need somebody out there speaking.
I'd rather be in the trenches reminding everyone else, right, of their right to get out there and speak.
But your message is, you don't pay, you don't get any say, is a great... The other one that's real important is when you have a nation of, like, Germany that's got 35% union, right? But there are only 62 million Germans.
Exactly.
You know, so what you're saying, the information you're saying is really important, and I never thought of it. If we could push back with this stuff, what do you mean unions aren't important? We still got more than anybody else in the world.
Right.
If we could push back against those people who keep, I mean, you say something's bad long enough, people will believe it. You'll get them to throw their own car away.
Right.
You know?
Right. And it's time for us to take back hope. I mean, real hope in ourselves, in believing in ourselves. That's what America's great at. You know, we're still the youngest kid on the block for the most part. We've reinvented ourselves. I mean, well, shoot, right? In Europe, they've
Let's steal back American exceptionalism.
Well, that's what I'm saying, right? I mean, because look, in Europe, yes, they have chairs older than the country, our country, right? But who cares? We're still vibrant, and we can still take our vibrancy back. We got to stop blaming other people who are just trying to get ahead. We got to blame the folks who are doing this. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you've got a Congress full of millionaires, I mean, I know it's simple, but it's just blame the people responsible.
I'm with you.
Hey, you know, you have a Congress full of millionaires that are giving themselves tax breaks. You know, how about this? We were just talking about this in the other room. Why don't we make sure that every public official, they are only allowed to get the same benefit and pay package as the public servants?
Or the people.
Or the people.
If 50 million people don't have health care...
Guess what?
Yeah, the same percentage of Congress doesn't get it either.
Does not get health care.
Yeah.
Let's see if we can get this. I mean, and I understand the Affordable Care Act was passed. I have my own concerns about that. I'm not an expert, but, you know, I prefer not to do these giveaways to the drug companies and even these large insurance companies. Bismarck. It is called the... I'm sorry. This came to me out of the blue. I've been thinking about this for 2 days. In Germany, for 150 years, they've had a government-sponsored, a government-subsidized private insurance plan that has benefited them since Otto von Bismarck was running Germany.
Yep.
Why can't we do that?
Because for the same reason Michelle Bachmann said we should not have a minimum wage and didn't know they already did it in Haiti.
Well,
you know, because of what you just
again,
said.
Once again, You don't follow the popular pretty people. I'm just going to say this.
But the sad reality is...
Michelle Bachmann.
I do. I love crazy.
She looks good.
Yeah, I love crazy. Crazy's good.
But that's where my hope is that we can do it. And yes, it's getting hard, and maybe this is what it takes to wake people up, to understand, okay, we've got to do something about this. And to just go back to our history.
Yeah.
I mean, if the Knights of Labor can form after the Civil War and be fully integrated with women and African Americans who are freed slaves, we're slow. We're behind the curve here, right?
Absolutely. And maybe, it's, as I've always said, you know, the old labor saying of when your stomach's empty, your head gets right. Maybe we have to get to that. And, you know, I got to be honest, after 2008, I thought that moment had happened.
Yeah.
But then again, you look at the elasticity programs, the unemployment, the food stamps, all of that stuff, push people to the periphery, push them. You know, you go back to the Depression, you saw lines of people.
Right.
We didn't see those lines.
Exactly.
We pushed people into their homes. We pushed people off.
And by hiding
yep.
those issues, poverty, blight, then it gets everyone to, and then creation of these great entertainment districts that allow you to drive through dilapidated areas, but you'd get to hang out in this fun place. You were not engaged. I mean, where are the calls for civic engagement? I mean, real calls, you know, on the fundamental level. You know, one of the most difficulties, everyone knows we're about to come to another midterm election. And I know we're all concerned because that's when people usually turn off. Here, I mean, our last mayor and city council were elected with less than 17% of the voters out. Now, to me, I expressed this then, I'm concerned for our democracy's at stake. We're heading towards voter nullification. Yeah. Because what I notice, it's not apathy. It's people fundamentally do not feel like the system no longer works for them. And that is where we're heading towards if we don't, again, re-engage, fight back.
Educate.
And organize. And organize.
I got to tell you, Chad, you know, in this couple of minutes we had to talk to you, I'm ready to get out in the streets. I'm ready to take to it. Let's get to it.
I want to go to Philadelphia and visit his mother, too. Absolutely. Tell her what a great
I'll let you know. But please, I got to call ahead of time because, you know, she doesn't like people just dropping in.
I can understand that, especially us.
Chad Johnson, Executive Director of Ask Me Local 1733. We appreciate you taking time for us. Thanks so much.
Glad to come to Memphis.
Look forward to talking to you again, and we will. Quick break, right back. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You know they're gonna push us around, Mr. Heft and Diggin, Mr. Hardick and Hauling, cause I'm gonna leave it in the ground. Mr. Taft and Diggin, Mr. Hardick and Hauling, Mr. Reagan can supervise the crew. And if they find it too hard, they got the National Guard to fix the bayonets and shovel like fools. He's gonna take a lot of long and an 80 short days for this miner to cool on down. Mr. Taft can dig it, Mr. Hardick can haul it, cause I'm gonna leave it in the ground.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
I work for the state now, helping kids with disabilities. I love the work, hate the rules, for bosses and you would believe. We had layoffs again this morning, I got my children now that I can see. Parents are angry, how can I blame them? They end up blaming me.
This afternoon, Pat, we went down to the National Civil Rights Museum. And one of those moments, one of those somber moments where I had the kids and we're looking up at the balcony where King was shot. And, you know, what you remember from history is, you know, completely different than you find out later. Like, when I was a kid, I never found out it was about sanitation workers. The reason that King was in this city was to stand up and fight for workers organizing.
Regardless of color.
Regardless, and that's the important part of this. It was all workers. Yeah. It didn't matter. And, you know, the more you dig into this and the more, you know, the more we learn about history, the more important I think it is to remember that, you know, it is the workers' struggle. And their struggle is our struggle, and it continues today. And it's passing it down.
Well, I think if we had been told the truth, especially as little white kids, we wouldn't have understood it wasn't us versus them anymore. It was all of us together need to work. To be, but they kept us all separate by not telling us the whole truth.
Well, divide and conquer, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm sitting here with Keith Johnson. He's a chairperson for AFSCME Local 1733, the sanitation union that King was down here helping fight, and the whole "I Am a Man" campaign, which is just, you know, to me, there we learned about each of them.
Yeah.
Just not together.
Yeah.
And that's one of those things that's remarkable. Keith, I appreciate you taking time to sit down and talk with us.
Thank you for having me here.
You know, and going back through the history of this, and one of the things that we're doing with our tour, the People's Tour for America, is we're going across the country where we're discovering the history that we didn't learn in the textbooks.
Wait. They're not learning it today either.
Well,
right.
Not at all.
It's still not in the textbooks.
Right.
So the whole point of this is we wanted to go out and talk to people like you who, you know, this is what you've lived. This is the, you know, as someone who's been part of this, we want your story in all of this.
What's it like in your workplace? I mean, is MLK Jr.'s picture everywhere at work?
No, it's not.
No.
You know, we work at different sites, barns. There's a lot of things they don't even want us to wear to work pertaining to this.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, we come in there with a Dr. King shirt on or something like that. We can't wear that.
Really?
Really.
He needs to come back.
Right.
Wow. There's a $29 million museum in this
right,
town.
Right.
Sucking people in from all over the planet.
Right.
And then the people that he was fighting for can't even wear a shirt with him on it.
Right.
Now, you've been a sanitation worker here in Memphis, in the local that King was here fighting for. For how long?
28 years.
28 years. Now, that's obviously not back in 68. But
right.
I'm sure you've known some of the people who did march, who did hold those I am a man signs, and who were part of that movement. What did they pass down to you?
Well, they passed on, first of all, that you got to fight for something that you believe in and don't give up. And you have to stand and fight during conditions that was so bad. I mean, just terrible conditions.
People literally died on the job.
They died on the job, and it's actually to the point the filth behind it was just ridiculous, where you were choking tubs and maggots would be all in. You had to put cotton in your ears, and it was maggots, and you had to put cotton in your nose. When you get home, your wife wouldn't let you in the front door. You had to stop on the porch. And by the time you shake you take the cotton ball, shake your pants, and maggots all over the front porch because you had to tote the tub. Some was actually standing off in the garbage. They would bring the tubs to the can, and you had guys up in the truck standing in the garbage. When they poured the garbage in the truck, they're standing in it, and they had to bring it to them. You had guys up there pouring the garbage around their feet. So it was terrible.
And it's no wonder that people said, we're not taking this anymore, because I'm of the mindset, you know, things get so bad, there's only so much of you-know-what people are willing to eat, and there was that point.
Right. And it was just, you know, it was terrible. And the working conditions to the point in the rain, and we had a couple of guys that actually got killed. The guy in the back of the truck, it was raining, and they said the truck malfunctioned. But, you know, to keep them out the rain, they was trying to cover themselves. It was raining real hard, and the blade came down and killed both of them. And it's so amazing now that this city now have came back within the last year and a half, forcing us to work in the rain again.
Oh.
And see, I listen to that. It's symbolism for what's going on in this country. I mean, you know, that sends a clear message to me that, you know, the advancements of workers, all of the organizing and all the fighting to better conditions, we're back to where we started from almost.
It's almost a deeper fight now. The conditions was worse then. The pay was lousy. But it's to the point now they was actually fighting in for better working conditions and better wages. Now it's to the point that they're taking money from us. And the fight now is also still the same today, better working conditions, better wages. But the flip side of that now is also to a point we're not only fighting for that, we're fighting to keep our job. We constantly hear about privatization every year.
Yeah.
And now we fighting actually to keep it. Then they was fighting for better working conditions and wages, but now we fight for that also to even have a job. Yeah. This is every year.
Yeah, I mean, it's a movement – you know, across the country, and for me to look at the place where all of this kind of spearheaded at one point, where things did get better, there's a lot of symbolism here for me, Keith.
Yeah, it's to the point. It's some of the things that has been said is truly amazing. We was quoted as once they call us sacred cows, to the point that we feel like we sacred because of Dr. Martin Luther King, that we cannot be touched. Every time privatization comes, they say we always talk about Dr. King and what he stood for. And they say we're not sacred anymore. You know, that's the only reason why we're still here, because we sacred cows that's holding us in there. They wanted to privatize us.
Well, you are if someone could privatize the people that Dr. King was fighting for when he died, then it would be game up for everybody else in the country. You may not be a sacred cow.
You'd be the big fish.
What you are is the big fish.
We
you
are
the one to take down.
We are. And once they do that, we already know. That's why we fight so hard every day, because we know if they take us down, it's a lot of people across the United States now feel like we have it good. They don't understand the struggle and the fight that we have. And the more it spread across the United States, people begin to understand what they're actually trying to do. And it's a struggle, and it's a fight.
It's always a struggle. I mean, it's always a struggle for, you know, the people who have so much to take from those who have so little.
Right.
And, you know, I look at this, and, you know, I guess the question that I have, you know, you knew people who were there at the beginning. They over your 28 years, they passed this down to you.
Right.
What about the next generation? What about the next guy coming on? What have you passed down to them?
What we're doing now is we're making sure that they see that we're going to fight to the end. We're going to keep fighting and fighting. And we're trying to instill inside of them knowledge of how to fight. A lot of people get it wrong, figure that since I'm a representative of the union and the director and everybody that's in the internet in the union, that they feel like they could pay their union dues and we're going to do all the fighting. But we're trying to instill inside of them that they are the union.
Absolutely. And that's an extremely important point, because what the right and the wealth class of this country has done masterfully is to try and convince not only, you know, union members but non-union members that it's the union.
Yeah.
It's like people like they've done to us, the citizens, about our government. It's the government.
Right.
It's this evil entity outside of you. We love you.
Right.
Oh, we love you, Keith. You're a great worker. You do an amazing job, you know, on the truck there. But it's that union. They're the bad ones.
Right.
And I guess it's an education process of saying, hey, we're all in this together.
Right. And the knowledge is, you know, when they explain this to them, you know, and most of them that feels this way and listen to this mess, it always seems like the Lord brings them back around to they actually see, because as soon as you piss one of them off after they told you all this, then they want to run back to us. But we take them with open arms. I mean, because everybody make mistakes.
Yeah.
Sometimes we tell them, we told you so. Now you're back, you know, but since you're back, now are you willing to fight with us?
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people have to, it's hard, and a lot of them have to go through that. And they just sit back and figure we're going to do all the work, and they don't want to fight. But numbers, we come together in numbers. People listen. The council, a lot of them listen. A lot of them get afraid when you come in numbers. But if you come with a few, oh, they say, well, you know, they don't care.
Mm-hmm.
So the more numbers that we bring together, the more people fight, it makes it more easier.
Right. Well, I mean, I guess the message would be if your members don't care enough to get out and do it, you know, then it must not be that important.
Right. And that's what they think. But I remember some of them was just lazy. But, you know, we actually...
Maybe that's because you guys have done too good of a job representing them.
I asked a question to them. Some of them, I like, you pay your union dues every month. And by you paying your union dues every month, I say, if you pay for go see a concert, are you going to show up? You spent your money, right? Okay, I said, well, you pay your union dues. This is more important than a concert, because if we lose your job, you ain't going to be able to go to a concert
anyway.
There's
no concerts for you, right?
It's more important for you to show up for the money that you're paying, come out and fight for actually what you're paying for, and then you could go forward.
Absolutely.
You know, though, I wonder if it's more, I can't imagine a sanitation worker being lazy. To tell you the truth, that's not the work for a lazy person.
Can't. You,
me, see this, what I do? Lazy. Right? I hold a microphone.
I'm doing it.
My butt just gets bigger. That's the whole thing. But maybe it's they don't think they have power. Is that part of the problem? That, like, maybe it's like, even if I go to the concert, at least I can sit there and listen to it. But if I go to the meeting, what am I going to contribute? I'm nobody. I mean, maybe they need some self-confidence or...
Right.
You know?
But they, you know, we try and instill that inside of them.
Yeah.
Because like you say, getting out on a truck right now, like now it's 100 degrees.
Yeah.
And we pick up whatever people throw away, the smell and all this, you know, and... People trying to take this away from you. We do this with pride.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you set up it because we're serving the citizens. We do this with pride. But, you know, when you do it, you just, a lot of them just sit back and, want us to do the job, you know, come out and represent them. A lot of them figure it's just representation.
Right.
It's not just representation. You're in a union for a reason. We represent you when management do you wrong. But you're in there to make it grow.
Mm-hmm.
And make it better, because when our kids do grow up, you know, the bottom line is we want it better for them. We want it better for them than what we have now.
And for the people who before you made the conditions, so you don't have to be on the back of that truck in the rain, slip and fall in, and you end up dead like those guys back in 68.
Right, but then, now they're trying to take that.
Yeah.
So if they're trying to take it.
What would happen if you guys had an action at the hotel.
Had an action?
If you had a labor action, if you had a labor strike.
Do you guys do that? Do you guys do actions at the site where King was assassinated?
We do actions all over.
All over?
Mm-hmm. I have our members to meet in front of City Hall with signs, protests, and all this kind of stuff. Yeah. We do that.
Good publicity? How's the media treat you?
Me, myself, over the last 5 or 6 years, the media has been coming out, but the mayor and the people of this city, you could feel it and you could hear it to a certain point. The media go away from me. Hmm. It's certain people that I talk to. There's certain things that be important, but somehow the mayor dictate.
Somehow those workers don't seem to be all that important.
Right.
You know, though, I got to tell you, I've been in the media for 25 years. They don't make trash. They are angels, and everything they have that's dirty just floats to heaven. They'll throw anything away. God forbid there's a sanitary pad ever in any of those fancy girls' houses.
Right.
I'll bet you Mitt Romney thinks that when the trash goes out in front of his house, it's just magic. Kind of like when he pushes the little things on the screen.
Like flowers.
No, he doesn't have trash. It just goes away like magic. Right. Like the screen at the Wawa where the sandwich, you press a button, it just comes.
Right.
It's magic.
He just drives around with the trash on the roof of his car until it flows off like the dog.
Nice. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here in Memphis, Tennessee, the People's Tour for America. You can follow us where we've been, where we're going, who we're talking to, peoplestourforamerica.com. We're sitting here with Keith Johnson. He's a chairperson for Ask Me Local 1733, the sanitation workers local. You know, and looking at this, you know, Keith, and to me, I'm not surprised that your local is under attack, because what we're seeing across the entire nation is an attack on people who pick up our garbage,
right,
who inspect our food, who keep the streets safe, who put out our fires, who do all the work that we, the people, say that we need to have done. So it's not surprising to me that you're under attack, because the reality is all of us are in that shark tank.
Right.
All of us are the ones that are being attacked. And I get the questions, the line that I've got for you, is in looking at public workers in Pennsylvania who are under attack right now, their pensions are about to be stolen and the governor's changing all of that. You know, what's the message out of this? You know, what do we do to push back on these assaults?
First, we keep fighting, we keep uniting, and we're going to have to also, we have family. We got to have protests. We got to bring our families.
So we got to go to the streets.
Go to the streets. You got to bring our families involved. Like in 1968, there was a number of sanitation workers out there, but they had their sons, their daughters, they had their mothers, they had their sisters, their brothers, they had all of them out there. And they was actually standing up as well, and that means the citizens of Memphis was behind them. And we all have to come together, not just the sanitation worker. We're going to bring our family. Everybody need to bring
our friends, our neighbors,
right,
the community.
Bring in Philadelphia. Need to bring everyone.
So let me ask you.
But at least they have a pension.
Because we talk about this quite often. You know, the reality is people do need to get to the streets, but there's a disconnect. They've done such a great job over the last 40 years of dividing us and pitting us, public sector, private sector, union,
right,
non-union, white, black, you know, white collar, blue collar, green collar, ring around the collar, all of that. They've done such a great job. How do we cross those divides?
Well, what we do is we knowledge. We put it in God's hand first, and we got to go out and instill knowledge that we all are created equal. That we is there, when you're talking about color, there is no color. God there's no color. He sees no color. And we all got to come together together because, with the citizens and with the workers, actually, this city, it would affect everyone. It would affect everybody in this city because all these private sides, when they come out, it's not going to get better. We got to go out and kick knowledge to the citizens and let them know it's not going to get better. Right now, you have a voice simply because the city council, you elect them in. Okay, you have a voice. But if you sit up here and privatize out, let them do this, the bottom line is a private company could come in the first year and treat you nice.
Oh, yeah. First couple of years, they may even be nice.
Right. But then you took it out of the citizens' hands,
yep,
because it's privatized now.
I've seen it.
Yeah, and then look, it's going to blow up.
Absolutely. And then they double your rates, and then they triple your rates, then you can't go back.
You can't
buy those trucks, Ken. You can't get the, you know, all those workers are gone.
That's
Isn't
it.
That the goal?
Yeah. And they got something now trying to get us with management competition, which I do not understand. The mayor here is management competition, like we could organize on and bid against a company like BFI. And, like, we're the workers. How are we going to bid against, here in Memphis, against BFI, and actually outbid them?
Well, because you're willing to work for free. That's how you do it. It's a competition to see who's willing to work for less and in worse conditions. And the sad reality is they want to go back before 1968, the conditions that those people fought against. It's nothing new. Keith Johnson, we really appreciate you sitting down with us.
Thank you, fam.
Enjoyed the time. Thanks so much, chairperson for Ask Me Local 1733, the sanitation local here in Ask Me. Keith, thank you. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show.
Freeway ride, but they slashed our funding, they cut all our hours by Washington decree. So here I stand with a long line of cars, everyone yelling at me. When did I become a problem? How did the fault become online? The president says, tightening the belt, the only one that's tightening is mine.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by Ask Me Council 13.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Undivided, we shall never fall. Remember all, we need to trust in and then forever call. Our brothers and our sisters, and are you and I aware? You and I both know that we can't rely on it. The time is time, planets aligned and no mistaking. Reunion resurrection, the anger has awakened. Has awakened a sleeping giant. Come on, yeah, we can do it. We need to revive, react, and re-up the labor movement.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. You know, one of the things that caught me in listening to those interviews, you know, you go back and you think about some of the things that we're talking about. I said, a guy in his 70s dying on the job in this day and age because no retirement whatsoever. Is that the future of the country? You go back and these interviews were back over the summer. You heard Chad Johnson talking about the idolatry of money that now, you know, months later, you've got the Pope saying, hey, we've got this idolatry of money, this idolatry of greed. And, you know, so many things in looking back at our time in Memphis that caught my attention that I think are just, you know, important lessons of the civil rights movement, important lessons of King's legacy that today are as important as they were then. And, you know, you look back at the history and you see that things really have not changed an awful lot. Things have changed. It's a different world. But when you talk about the economics, when you talk about the distribution of wealth, things really haven't changed all that much for people at the very bottom, but have changed an awful lot for the people at the top, where they have collected more and more of the wealth, more and more of the gains. And in a smaller number of hands, I mean, even the stratification of those at the very, very top, where you have a 0.1% that is now garnering more and more and more. It's the viper. It's the scorpion that's sucking us dry. It's something that, going forward, we're going to have to continue to fight. And understand, they're not going to go quietly. They're going to spend heavily. Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed our program tonight. Make sure you check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of it, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on the smartphone. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk. It's color like the tile.